when the Pentagon was approached by Bill Gates and the EcoHealth Alliance, and they wanted to release protein crystals in China, and the Pentagon said, here's one telegraph, that's a bio attack. That could lead to nuclear war. We're not going to do that. Well, that now takes us to Dr. Giordano, who's the head neuroscientist at Georgetown, at the top Pentagon Air Force DARPA meeting.
Some ongoing studies with our colleagues in the medical branches of NATO have in fact shown that the use of nanoparticulate matter in a scatter arrangement can be used to incur what looks to be broad-scale epidemiological stroke epidemics. So what we're able to do here is infiltrate the brain space with nanoparticulate matter that aggregates in situ, on site in the brain. And there's one of two things, either penetrates from the vascular space, gets in through the bloodstream, gets in through the nose, through the mucosa, or infiltrates the vascular space and clogs it. What is the result? What's called a nanoparticulate stroke or a hemorrhagic diathesis, fancy word, for it's a predisposition to individuals having brain bleeds. Demonstrated? Oh, absolutely. We're able to show animal models of same, and the Italian group has done a fair amount of work demonstrating that nanoparticulate matter can be highly disruptive, not only of brain vascularity, but brain function. You may not necessarily incur a stroke, but you're going to begin to disrupt the network properties of the brain, and as a result, engage something more of a long wars effect through the use of these types of matters, where you now begin to influence the population in increasingly concentric circles of expansion.
Oh, did you hear next month the new COVID variant vaccine's ready? It's a new nasal spray. You just talked about nasally, which gives you a thing that grows protein crystals, then you spread. Isn't that loving and liberal?
We are following some breaking medical news for you. Researchers at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center are working to develop the first nasal spray vaccine for COVID-19. The spray does not need to be administered by a medical professional and does not require refrigeration. Clinical trials are now planned for the U.S. and Africa.
Nothing I'm telling you here is sci-fi. It all exists within the medical range and how we're able to treat a variety of neurological disorders targeting the brain, being able to get in there more specifically, affect certain neural cancers, etc. And we spoke earlier about a technique that's become very well known, CRISPR-Cas9, that allows us to literally modify bugs in a variety of different ways. So I now may be able to take a relatively harmless microbiological agent, a bacterium or a virus, do some gene editing and make this thing far more morbidly viable, make it far more virulent, and in some cases even make it far more lethal.
Gene editing, gain of function, illegal as hell. I'm not ever going to surrender. I physically can't do it.
It's my great honor.
F*** you, Klaus Schwab. F*** you. I got plenty of words for you, but at the end of the day, f*** you and your new world order, and f*** the horse you rode in on, and all your f***. And so they know if that spirit begins to, in their words, infect other people, it's game over for them to turn us into robots and play God and give us all these orders and tell us how to live and tell us what to do.
You're talking about Oxford and the Oxford Council that has just announced that it's going to break up Oxford into 15-minute communities, call them 15-minute cities, where everything that they say you need is within the 15-minute walk or cycle ride of where you live. And that you cannot, under this proposal, leave your 15-minute city in a car more than 100 times a year, or you find every time you do. Now, what is that? That's simply lockdown. It's COVID lockdown. But it's done under the guise of climate change.
And so that's what this is really all about, is your ability to have free will that God gave you, and they're trying to take that away.
The only thing God managed to create are organic beings. All these trees and giraffes and humans, they are just organic. But we are now trying to create inorganic entities, inorganic life forms, cyborgs, artificial intelligence, and so forth. If we succeed, and there is a very good chance we will, then very soon we will be beyond.
That's why I oppose them, and that's why I fight them. And they act like, oh, they understand the universe, and they're bringing balance to it. And no, they like to hurt people. They like to destroy children. They like to steal people's energy. They like to see people in miserable situations because it makes them feel good because they hate themselves. Hundreds of different serial killers and psychopaths.
It's almost poetic, the products that we sell, because yes, they are the best. Yes, it is the best price for the highest quality. Yes, they are third-party tested. It's almost poetic because as we advocate for humanity, what we sell to you is that which makes you or allows you to make yourself a better version of yourself. Whether it's getting the methylene blue, which helps you with focus and energy and mental clarity, or ultimate life force, which makes your body healthier in so many ways I don't have the time to explain to you. Whether it's the Shilajit that gives you incredible vitality, or the ultimate burn, which ensures that your metabolism is optimal, or the optimal human, which is everything the body needs. You see, we're fighting for your mind, your body, and your soul, not just with the products that we sell, but with the message of this network. We have to have the truth. We have to have freedom of speech. We have to have our rights, because, folks, we're about ready to go into an artificial intelligence war, into a space war, the likes of which humanity couldn't even dream of, even in science fiction. So please go to thealexjonesstore.com right now, not just for your mind and your body, but for your species.
It's Thursday, August 21st, in the year of our Lord, 2025. And you're listening to The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at band.video.
I think it's time to blow this thing, get everybody in the stuff together. Okay, 3, 2, 1, let's jam.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The American Journal. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Thursday morning. Hope everybody's doing well. Hope you're drinking a particularly strong cup of coffee today. We got a big show for you. We got a lot to get into. And I feel like I'm the man for the job, I have to say. I feel like you're in the right place if you are somebody contending, perhaps for the first time, with the shattering of the Overton window. And I really gotta, I guess, watch my words here. But I'm a little bit baffled at what's going on right now. I'm a little bit confused at what is being stated publicly for the first time in my life. And in fact, unless you're really, really old, for the first time in your life as well. And that is, you know, primarily what I'm talking about is the interview with Tucker Carlson yesterday with this Ivy League professor who basically said Hitler was the good guy in World War II and that we should have been on the side of the Nazis. What? I know people are starting to look into the official story more than perhaps they used to. But I still thought we were maybe a couple years down the line from this. I went viral yesterday just literally retweeting it saying, bruh, what is happening? What is going on here? What is happening? Apparently everybody else has that question too. I'm gonna try to figure this out. Right, let me correct myself. I figured this out a long time ago. Let me start over. I figured this out years ago. Years and years and years and years ago. So I feel like I have a moral obligation to try, as we always have, guide people out of the cave. And that is the metaphor that we're constantly invoking because it's the appropriate one. And again, I feel like I have a responsibility here. And we'll get to the video and I'll show it to you. Like I wish there was a way that I could express to everybody all at once, like I really want you to trust me on this. I don't know how to put it. Like with Alex Jones, there are times when Alex and I disagree on things, or I hear his interpretation and I have a different interpretation. We don't actually coordinate our messaging. He doesn't tell me what to say. Nobody tells him what to say. And we all come to our own interpretation on things. Although usually they're, you know, fairly well aligned just naturally because we apply the same sort of logic to each situation. But when there is a situation where Alex thinks something differently than I do, I tend to go with Alex's understanding. Not because I have to, not because he's my boss and I'm trying to kiss ass, but because I respect the fact that he has like 20 years of experience over me and has been doing this for 20 years longer than I have and has better, you know, sources and higher levels than I do, why wouldn't I, again, not just like give over to his interpretation, but probably assume that I'm missing something, not the other way around. And again, to me, that is just, it's not even about it's about respect. Obviously, it's about respecting like what he's been through and how right he's been for so long. But it's also just, for me, a matter of pattern recognition. And just going, there have been times in the past where I thought Alex was wrong about stuff, and he was right, and I was wrong. Sometimes in like catastrophic ways. Like, I was wrong about January 6th on January 6th. I thought it was super cool. I was very into it. I wasn't there. I was here, and I was watching what had happened on January 6th, and I was going, hell yeah, we're storming the Capitol. This is what these people deserve. I was all for it. Because I'd watched an entire year of people, you know, burning down local libraries and being told this is the voice of the voiceless. And I was excited to revel in some reciprocal behavior. Alex Jones saw right through it and went, this is a trap. I got to get people away. Thank God he was there and I wasn't, right? In this way, I try to be a humble person, but I think I got to not be humble about this stuff because we're in a difficult situation here. I'm in a difficult situation here. I really don't like not being humble. I like being humble. I genuinely am. But I also wish people understood that I know, whatever. I know more about this than most people. And at this point, people that think they know more than me, it's like there's a situation where like you're so far ahead in the race that the people following you can't see you and they think they're winning. And that's kind of where we are at this point. So like yes, here's a good example, okay? This guy does this interview with Tucker Carlson. Tucker guest Dave Colum says, well, it turns out I think the story we got about World War II is all wrong. One can make the argument that we should have sided with Hitler. And he talks about General Patton saying this. And he talks about Pearl Harbor and a bunch of others. So I'll show you the clip in just a second. And so I retweet this and say, bruh, what is happening? Okay. Now, under that, I say, hey, at Irving Brooks, you see this prick. Okay. I get a lot of people underneath that mad at me for calling this guy a prick. Okay, because it sounds like what I'm doing is calling him a prick. But see, I forget sometimes a lot of people, they haven't done their research. They haven't done their homework. I sort of say things on the assumption that we're all on the same level, and we're obviously not. Okay? If you've ever watched any speech from David Irving from the late 80s, which you all should have by now, then you'll know that he started every single speech he ever gave by making a joke. And his joke was that the Holocaust was a lie that was like a big balloon. And the more people, the more information gets pumped out about it, the more inflated the balloon gets, and it gets bigger and bigger and gets sort of wobblier and wobblier. And he's like, the whole thing is unstable, and all that needs to come along is one little prick, and that whole, you know, balloon explodes. I am that prick. He'd always make that joke, all right? So I'm referencing this inside joke from David Irving, noted Holocaust denier. But people think I'm calling the Holocaust denier a prick. My point is that something has happened where the Overton window has been shattered, where the story that underlies the construct of our entire world, if you look around, it's not hard to see that like the majority of the geopolitical decisions are made on the basis of how do we stop the next Hitler? That our morality itself is at this point been rearranged into a gradient, a spectrum where Hitler's on one side and not Hitler's on the other. And that determines how good you are, whether you're good, what you're doing is good, because you can do the same thing. But if you're Hitler, it's bad. If you're not Hitler, it's good. And that is what decides morality, right? And we've talked about this and shown examples of stories in like Southern California where like a woman with a swastika armband is like savagely beaten by a group of men who rip her clothes off, and then she gets thrown into prison for inciting violence. And it's like, how is that? So it's okay to beat a woman and rip her clothes off because she's wearing a shape you don't like. Okay. To me, this is what the Nazis did. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if you heard exactly the same story, only it was in Nazi Germany and it was a Jewish person wearing a yarmulke that a bunch of men got together, and I guess women don't wear yarmulke, whatever. Some woman wearing a Star of David necklace and a bunch of Nazi men beating her up and ripping it off her and then sending her to jail for daring to show a symbol like that in Nazi Germany, right? So the underlying morals of what's actually happening, they're the same, only one is against the swastika, one's against the Star of David, and therefore they're on completely ends of the moral spectrum when Hitler is your Y-axis. So all this is to say that there's a reason that, like, part of me wants to just apologize because I've been saying the same stuff since I started working at InfoWars, since I started the show 5 years ago. Like, it must be exhausting. I'm sorry. I wish I had, you know, new things to say, but the fact is, you think about this stuff, you think about it thoroughly, you take in all the information you possibly can from every different side, you come to a conclusion, and then that's just the conclusion. And then from then on, anytime this stuff gets brought up, you don't have to think about it. You've already thought about it. I have the answer for you. I've been saying the answer over and over forever. Now, some people on the right, like Jordan Peterson, said for a long time his role was to stop the excesses of the right. His entire purpose of becoming a, you know, public personality was to sort of hijack the energy of the right and make sure it didn't go towards Nazism. And so he saw his role. Now, I don't see myself in that role. The role I see is of myself is to uphold my ancestral heritage of America and what America is and how America is the answer to all of this. The American ideal, the American dream, the American Constitution. We don't need National Socialism. We don't need communism. We don't need socialism of any sort. We need Americanism. We need to get back to what our country is supposed to be, what it was founded on, the not just laws, but the morals underpinning 1776. That's the answer. And it really is. It really is the answer. But again, for the last 5 years that I've done this show, anytime somebody's called in and asked about something like the Europa documentary or something, I always have the same answer. And if you've watched me, you already know what the answer is, which is the mainstream documentaries tell one side of the story and give absolutely no credence to any other side of the story. And when you have a populace or an individual that is curious and thoughtful and intelligent, they'll see that they're missing something. They'll recognize that the story as being presented doesn't make any sense. There are plot holes in it. The classic, you know, meme about it is like, okay, the Germans all just went crazy for a couple years. They were all good people. They're all normal, upstanding individuals. Then Hitler came to power. Somebody gave Hitler a microphone. He went, let's all be evil. They all went, okay. And then for a couple years, they were super evil and bad, and nothing they ever did was even remotely good. And then we defeated Hitler, and they all went back to being benign again. Okay, a normal person watching that, who's able to resist propaganda and creative rhetorical framing, can see there's something missing here. What's the other side of the story? Now, the problem is the only people telling that other side of the story are only telling that other side of the story. So you go from the History Channel, Hitler bad, Nazis bad, nothing they ever did was even remotely benign, let alone good, and it certainly had no legitimate, you know, purpose behind it or, you know, reason why in their mind this was not an evil thing to do. They'll tell you that side of the story. And then you go to like Europa or whatever, and it's actually Hitler and the Nazis were nothing but good. It was all rainbows and sunshine. Everybody was happy until the Allies came in and ruined it all. And it's like, that is an equally absurd story to tell. So the truth is obviously somewhere in the middle, and you can't get to that truth without acknowledging and interpreting both arguments. Really not that hard to understand. And the reason why we still, even though it's, you know, I mean, trust me, it is insane how easy it is to get popular on Twitter by just like saying Nazi stuff. Anytime I even like make a joke about Nazism, it just like is incredibly popular. Now, part of me is kind of suspicious as to why that is, because we know how powerful algorithms are, and it does seem like you say offensive things and they get spread to more people. Maybe people just like it. Maybe that is the prevailing sentiment, or maybe it's algorithmic. I don't know. But what I know is that it's a false dichotomy between Nazism and communism, white people and Jews. And there's a purpose that they want you in that dichotomy. And it's like, even from just a purely materialistic standpoint, it's like Hitler lost, right? This is one of those things. People are like, oh, you know, Hitler's the answer. It's like, he lost so bad. Do you have any idea how badly that guy lost? worse than you could possibly imagine. Now, we don't know, because we can't have the alternative timeline. Everything is speculation. You know, maybe Hitler never rises and communism takes Germany and then sweeps through the rest of Europe and, you know, is so dominant that there's no force to fight against it. Maybe we're all living under literal 1984 hell world communistic full planet takeover. Maybe. And if that was the case, you could make the argument. That's like, well, without the Nazis, we'd all be communists. So like, you can make that argument, but it's speculation. Nobody knows. What we do know, what Hitler did, ruined Germany forever. So you're really, that's the guy, huh? That's the guy you're going to follow? This is stupid. So again, part of me is just like, what is happening? How is the Overton window shattered to this degree? And while I think it's a good thing, because I think you do have to talk about all of this, you have to contend with this, because again, it's true, you know, the facts are out there. The books have been written. The documentaries have been made. People are going to see it. And just telling people, you're not allowed to look at that, you're not allowed to interpret that, isn't going to work, because they're human beings with free will. And you have to contend with that. So I just, we're going to get into it. I'll show you the clips. I'll show you the videos. But if this is new to you, if any of this information is the first time you're hearing this, if you've never known that General Patton was very outspoken against the Jewish behavior in Germany following the Second World War, and that he was likely assassinated because he had political ambitions and had started to pursue a different narrative in his head than the prevailing public sentiment as expressed through the media, if this is your first time hearing about this, maybe have some humility. Maybe, you know, maybe don't freak out. Because, again, I feel like I have a responsibility to talk about this stuff, in part because I can see a lot of people don't have the ability or willingness, I don't know, ability or willingness to create a projection of other people's minds in order to truly empathize with them. We have a story later I'll get to where it's like the right wing is rejecting empathy. I think empathy is the most powerful, you know, force here, because you got to be able to model the minds of both sides. And what I see is a lot. Here's how I'll put it, all right? You remember in Batman, either The Dark Knight or, you know, one of the Christian Bale Batmans, there's one of his underlings at Wayne Enterprises discovers that he's Batman. And there's that scene of Morgan Freeman's character, Fox, I think, going, "You think your boss dresses up like a bat, goes out and fights crime. You think your boss is the Batman and your plan is to blackmail this person? Guy's like thinks about it for the first time and is like, yeah, maybe this isn't such a good idea. That's kind of how I am. It's like, okay, so you're telling me that in your view, the Jews represent a highly organized, multi-millennia long cabal scheming to take over the earth. And they've had dominion for the last 80 years and the ability to trick everybody on earth and kill anybody they want. And your tactic is to yell about this. And your tactic is to name them. And that's your solution. So either it is true that the Jews are however they put it, 2,000 year old satanic pedophile cult trying to take over the world. In which case, maybe you have some tactical acumen when you approach this enemy, right? If that's the case, I mean, you're going to yell at them and you think that works. You're going to create an anonymous Twitter account and spam cartoon pictures of Jews. And that's your tactic of going against these people. So if it's true, you're being stupid. And if it's not true, then you're being especially stupid. Because when you really study this stuff and you really understand it from both sides, you see why there are stories and gossip and anecdotes. And that's the other problem with this is that you don't know what the hell is true. We don't know what the hell is true. We don't know if the things that are attributed to Patton are things he actually said or whatever. It's like, once you get back to the Second World War, I mean, factuality sort of flies out the window because everybody was lying about everything the entire time because it was war and because it was the beginning of mass communication and mass media and the intelligence operations in the UK and Germany and Russia were all figuring out how useful it was to spread big, gigantic lies to manipulate your entire population. So it's hard to get to the facts at the heart of it in the first place, but entertaining all of the facts and looking at it from every different direction and taking in things that people say, like the fact that Hitler was funded in the very beginning by the biggest Zionist movement in Germany, because the Zionists and Hitler were aligned at the beginning because Hitler wanted the Jews out of Germany and the Zionists wanted the Jews in Israel. So they made an agreement, the Havara Agreement or whatever it is. And so when you really study this stuff and you really look into it and you really approach it from both sides and you really have empathy for both sides and suspicion for both sides, then what you come to is, okay, this is a giant dialectic that's very useful to the most evil people who do not give a damn about either side, who are not Nazis looking for the perpetuation of the white race and also are perfectly willing to sacrifice literally millions of Jews to get what they want because it's useful, because it's convenient, because it's a highly effective, propaganda tactic. And so what you come to is the understanding that the only way to defeat this is to not engage in the dialectic, not give the bad people what they want, to tell the truth resolutely and, bravely and without leaving anything out just because it's inconvenient to your argument. Because if you want your argument to succeed, it's got to be based in the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's how we'll approach it. I'll show you the video on the other side. Because I can see how this goes off the rails. Because most people in America are loving people. So
I need support. We are maxed out. And I can do so much more in offense. Guaranteed beat them even faster in court. And got this other stuff going on. I'll leave it that with the Justice Department. The good guys coming in. And the task force on weaponization. That I need funds. So I need you to go to thealexjonesstore.com. Subscribe as your monthly donation for $30 a month as a VIP. And know you're doing that bare minimum of support. Cancel any time. Not a very hard commitment. You just do it month to month. You charge $30. You're a VIP. And when you want a t-shirt or you want a supplement, you get it because it'll just build up in your account. $40 to spend in the store. You spend 30, you get 40 automatic discounts on everything, special sales, special offers. I'm asking everyone to commit who's never supported the broadcast by buying anything to become a VIP today at thealexjonesstore.com. And then you know you're doing the monthly support. Ever have an issue, don't want to do it, cancel. One click, it's your profile. But by being a VIP, you get massive discounts, special offers, and so much more at theelegantstore.com. And it's a way to show your support. We need your backing. I am 100% dauntless. If anything, I get overheated because I've got so much energy and I'm so angry at these people and it bleeds off into my life. I need your backing. I'm backing you. Quite frankly, if you don't back me and my crew, what we're doing, you're nuts. And I'm not mad at you. I'm just saying you're crazy. Evil hates this transmission. We've got their number. And if you don't back the organizations fighting with everything they've got for you, because we're all in this together, well, you've rolled over. You've run up the white flag, quite frankly. And that's what this is. People ask, man, thanks for fighting. Thanks for never giving up. Wow, why does it break your spirit? It intensifies my spirit. To know we're up against pure evil and we're turning the tide and we're winning. And then to know that if we don't fight hard, they're going to win and commit humanity to a nightmare of evil. You think stuff's bad now? You ain't seen nothing yet. Thank me for fighting for my own future and yours collectively. There's not even a question of fighting these people. Look at them. They've got to be opposed. People tend to think, being persecuted is, oh, you want to stay away from that? Oh, so you want to stay away from the fight? No, it's like John Paul Jones said when he got commissioned as the head of the U.S. Navy, and Robert was starting, and he was writing to the Continental Congress. He said, I only want the fastest ships. I only want to be sent into the main war zones in direct action. They said, here, it's our fastest ship. Go out. He immediately goes out and engages and takes over all these British ships 2-3 times the size. Just ramming straight into them. Well, that's what I want to do. I only want the fastest ships. I want to go directly into action. I want to go 24 hours a day. I want reporters all over the country. I want to be 50 times stronger against the enemy. I want 50 times the audience. I want victory. You think what we've done to the enemy's been effective so far? It's nothing. I have not yet begun to fight. So support yourself. Support us. Do it. Or be conscious that you didn't fight when the time was right. You hesitated. You took this as another entertainment venue, to some other show. Just more talk. This ain't talk. This is the targeting coordinates to take down the enemy. This is the Death Star plans. This is Sting, the Goblin Slayer. They hate this blade. This operation is a sword that is plunged politically, culturally, spiritually into the hearts of our enemies over and over and over again. They hate it. It's a standard of their defeat. It's a symbol of their weakness. That's what we're doing here. This is serious business. So I'm coming to you, asking you to continue to commission us in this fight. We've already delivered you more victories against the enemy than any other media operation in the world. And I'm asking you again, for all of our collective futures, to come to our aid now more and take your fight to the 110% level. Tell the truth. Be accurate. Stand against evil. Have courage. Until it's not even having courage, it's what you are.
You're watching The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch live right now at band.video.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The American Journal. Again, I'm trying to contend with the shattering of the Overton window that has occurred. I don't know. Matt was saying I wasn't expressing myself clearly in that last segment. I hope I did. I hope people get where I'm coming from. What did you think I wasn't clear about? Is Matt still in there?
Oh, I'm right here.
All right. What did you think I wasn't clear about?
Well, I just didn't know if you wanted to add a Roman on top of all of them, or
wanted to pledge allegiance. This is the thing.
It's such a hard conversation to have because of maybe the first point that I think you were making about the Overton window. What is publicly acceptable to say, right, in public discourse? And I do think that the Overton window has rapidly moved now. In the right direction, I think, is kind of what you're debating, right? Is it going too far? Like, people are jumping to conclusions and being like, oh, yeah, like, all Jews run everything. The Jews are bad. Hitler was right. Hitler did nothing wrong, right? Which is, full tilt the wrong way.
Well, yeah. And I wouldn't even say, the Overton window is shifting in the in the wrong direction. I guess my point is just that you have to be able to, you know, look at both sides and actually come to your own conclusions and go, all right, you know, here's the reason that the Nazis gave for what they were doing. Now you can judge whether or not it's valid, but to say they had no reason is, there's going to be intelligent people that go, that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. You're telling me they just did this because they're bad. It's like, well, what was the purpose? What was the reason? Why were they doing it? And then you can look into it. And if you see, and like, again, you can agree with, you can say like, well, you know, they didn't like, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they didn't like whatever, but then they were, you know, imprisoning innocent people who'd never been convicted of a crime and never been charged with anything and weren't doing anything illegal on the basis of, you know, their, immutable characteristics. And you can say that's wrong. That's wrong. And they shouldn't have done that. I don't know. To me, it's not, really that difficult to comprehend. And again, it's just about being able to understand and see both sides. Not that there's good people on both sides, but that it's just childish to act like the Allies just told the truth all of the time and never did anything wrong. No, we did some pretty bad stuff, and it's
right. And that, well, not just that. Not the Allies didn't just do bad stuff. The Allies helped to fund Nazi Germany. There's so many U.S. companies, right, that are well known for supporting the Nazi war effort.
Usually. And look, and according to David Irving, he had the personal papers. I think it was of the person who was in charge of Spain at the time. I should really talk about David Irving a lot, because he's sort of the perfect example, the sort of poster boy for like this whole conversation. And I've told the story before, and I'll just try to tell it quickly. But essentially, he was a very, very successful historian, because after the Second World War, he went and worked in Germany. He was an Englishman. He went to Germany, worked there, and heard stories from the people there about Dresden and about the firebombing of Dresden. Now, this was a story that nobody in England knew. It was secret. It hadn't been told to their people. Like, again, this is what we're dealing with a war situation where they firebomb the city of Dresden, kill hundreds of thousands of people in the most horrific scenes of hell on earth you could possibly imagine, where like the flame is so hot that the stones are cracking and people are taking days to die of third degree burn. I mean, just horrible stuff. And the English people had no idea that they'd been a part of that. They had no idea that their government had done that. And so David Irving wrote this book about the firebombing of Dresden, and it became a bestseller in the UK, because again, this is, you know, kind of one of the things that separates us in the West with the Anglo-Saxon Protestant ideal from the Nazis or the authoritarians, the fascists of any category, is we want to know what our government does because we want to punish them if they do evil, right? Sort of incompatible with the, you know, authoritarian top down, do what you're told. You know, everything you believe comes from the state, right? Nazi Germany wouldn't brook people questioning their, you know, tactical decisions. But in the UK, this book became a bestseller because people in the UK were furious when they found out that their government had committed this horrific war crime and not told any of them. Sort of an Anglo-Saxon characteristic to want to know this stuff and to accept it and to be mad at your government.
Very white of you.
It's very white. No, like literally, yes. Right? It's like a white Christian Anglo-Saxon thing to do.
I feel like there's going to be a callback to that later in the episode.
Maybe so. But we talk about it literally every day with stuff like Israel, where like I'm always trying to make the distinction, like we don't do collective punishment. We don't do support your government even when it's committing war crimes. It's not American. It's not English. It's not Western European. That's not what we do. It's not in our character. And something like we reemphasize. So anyway, so David Irving writes his book, and the English people are grateful for him because they want to know this, right? And again, you can imagine if, I hate to use the example again, but I mean, when an Israeli person comes out and exposes the crimes that Israel is doing, the Israelis like throw him in jail. Like they're like, shut up. you know, like, you've, what are you doing? You're going to get us all killed. How dare you tell the truth about us? Like, that's one mindset. It's an authoritarian mindset. It is a dog eat dog. Just do whatever it takes to benefit your people, no matter what. And it's the mindset that, and like, really, when you look at it, it's kind of crazy how much of, Nazism was literally ripped straight from like the top Zionist thinkers of the time. I mean, the term master race was first written about the Jews by a Jewish author. And, Hitler kind of co-opted that. And early on, when Hitler was designing the National Socialist Party, he apparently, and again, all this is speculation because God only knows what the truth is, but apparently, according to, you know, reports of the time, Hitler was basically like, yeah, I just do what the communists do, only I'm doing it for Germany, not communism. Because you saw how effective the communist organization tactics were, so he did that, which is why you had the mobs of the black shirts and the mobs of the brown shirts, because Hitler was utilizing a lot of the communist tactics only for his side. So, I mean, again, all of it gets a little bit convoluted when you're looking to, like, assign blame for all this stuff. So, when David Irving writes this book about Dresden, not only do the UK people love him for it, because they were furious that their government had lied to them and committed such an atrocity, and of course the German people loved him for it, because they're like, oh my God, this guy's telling our story. There's an Englishman who is actually, you know, criticizing the English government and telling them the truth about what actually happened. And so because of that, he got access, firsthand access, to like everybody who was still alive from the Third Reich. Who wouldn't give interviews to anybody. They wouldn't talk to anybody. They wouldn't sit down. They wouldn't provide papers for anybody because they saw the Nuremberg trials went and all this stuff where, I mean, again, you can go back in time and like, anyway, I mean, it's also convoluted and mixed up. So the point is this. David Irving was a world famous, the number one historian in the UK and worldwide, really, but he was from the UK. He went to Germany and he got access to all of these diaries and all of these memos and all of these communications and letters and firsthand accounts from people in the Third Reich. And he'll give speeches where he goes, this hand has shaken more hands that shook the hand of Hitler than anybody else alive, right? Because it would be like Hitler's maid, you know, would give him a diary she stole from him, or Hitler's bodyguard or the grandson of Hitler's bodyguard would provide the, you know, journal that his grandfather had kept giving details. So he had access to all of this first-hand historical documentation that nobody else had access to. And that's what he worked off of. And he had a principle that he worked on where he would never cite anything except for first-hand sources. Because he says that historians have this sort of incestuous cycle they go through where a historian says something, another historian quotes that, another historian quotes him, another historian quotes him. And then like you get back to a certain point where the last historian is quoting the first historian, but the first historian is quoting the last historian. And you're like, well, then where did this information come from? They're all just quoting each other and there's no original source in it anywhere. And so for David Irving, he was like, I just don't do that. If I can't find a firsthand source, then I don't include it in my book. So he writes a biography about Hitler. And he doesn't include anything about the death camps, Auschwitz, the final solution, or the gassing of the Jews. And his publisher says, you've got to include at least 15 pages about the Holocaust. Capital H Holocaust. Trademark. So we can get into that too. But David Irving says...
They trademarked the Holocaust?
Well, there's different Holocausts, all right? There's the Little H Holocaust, which is the systematic murdering of non-combatants during the Second World War, which is a matter of historical fact and horrific, and the numbers are in the millions, and it's pretty much undeniable.
How many?
Well, that's the other question.
Say six.
Then there's the Capital H Holocaust, which is not a historical thing. It's a matter of faith. It's because it has all the tenets of a faith. It has strictures that you're not allowed to question, you're not allowed to look into, you have to accept and never question. It's like, I don't subscribe to that faith. You want to talk about the historical reality, we can get into that, and it's horrific and just as bad as pretty much anybody says it is.
Right. I mean, essentially, they did the prohibited stuff, right?
Well, and this is the thing with so let me... so
The science on mankind type stuff.
Well, yeah, They were not good people. And it wasn't just about Jews either. I mean, they literally just like, they didn't think
I'm gonna,
they didn't qualify as human. Like the people that were deformed or Slavic were not considered human and were therefore
liable I needed that to send to Greenblatt. Sorry.
Well, so again, this is why I'm talking about David Irving, because all this sort of comes together. And so David Irving wasn't a Holocaust denier by any means. He just was like, look, if you can give me firsthand accounts, I will include them in the story. But I have a principle that I stick to where I do not quote other historians. I just don't. I'll quote Hitler's diary. I'll quote the diary of his maid. I'll quote the things that his bodyguard told me. But I'm not going to quote another historian. So show me a firsthand document. Show me something I can work with that is an original document, and I'll do it. And there wasn't any, so he refused to do it. And so they called him a Holocaust denier and basically went after him to destroy his life. And so then he goes on the defensive and is like, the Jews are trying to destroy my life because I refuse to go along with their story. And he becomes, you know, and he sort of falls in this trap that a lot of people fall into, I think, where they become the thing that people say they are, right? He didn't start off as a Holocaust denier anti-Semite guy, but then when you have, you know, a giant consortium of Jewish people destroying his life in like a million different ways. I mean, they threw him in prison. They ransacked his office and confiscated all of his decades upon decades of, you know, notes and personal work. Like they really ran this guy through the ringer. Again, because I think he just didn't want to do something that was against his principles. And like, if you watch him, like later on, I believe his final sort of stance was he's like, I found documents. He's like, I found documents that confirm that yes, there were death camps, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially he's like, his argument at the end of it all was basically that by the end of the war, Hitler was so sort of, you know, focused on and stressed out on like the Eastern Front that his underlings, sort of without his knowledge, his underlings were the ones that were like the real vicious anti-Semites. This whole thing was, you know, again, his whole theory was that like Hitler, you know, use the anti-Jew sentiment in Germany at the time to sort of gain prominence, gain power. But once he became chancellor, that was not so useful to him anymore as a political tool to gain power. It's extremely useful. But once you're in power and he's trying to make deals with other countries that have Jewish people in their cabinets or whatever, it's not exactly the most useful thing to be a virulent anti-Semite. So he's like, we're going to kind of tamp that down a little bit. But his underlings, who were very, very ideologically and, you know, emotionally anti-Semitic, they weren't letting it go. And like they were killing Jews sort of behind his back or, you know, under his nose without him knowing. And so that's sort of like, if you watch David Irving forever, like that's sort of the conclusion that he comes to, is he's like, yeah, there were death camps. There was a systematic, almost mechanized death machine being run by the Nazis. Like, I don't think Hitler knew the details of it. I don't think he was the one ordering it. I think it was his underlings who were sort of the more anti-Semitic element that he couldn't get rid of because he needed them for survival, but couldn't really keep a handle on or a top on. Again, so, I mean, there's no cut or dry answer here in terms of like, yes, it did happen, or it's a total fraud. Again, that's the false dichotomy. It was a war. It was chaotic. There were people being murdered. There were death camps. There were slave camps. There were expulsions. There were uprisings that were quashed. There, I mean, it was chaos. It was madness. It was insanity. It was brutal. It was horrific. And it was, it ended with the absolute total destruction and degradation of the German people that we see now, where they're all gay and committing civilizational suicide as they all are, overrun by Turks. So well done, Hitler. So great job. Well, yeah, great job. You did it. You did it. Congratulations. They're destroyed forever. Well done. And people think like, oh, we gotta do what he did. What? Lose in the most hilariously terrible way you could possibly imagine? My God. Why would you want to emulate that guy? Again, it's not even about like counter signaling, whatever. It's just look at the history. Why would you want to model yourself after that dude? It doesn't make any sense. And so, to me, again, that you just look at somebody like David Irving, sort of like what he went through, and you can sort of see all sides of it, and you can sort of just go, all right, is that what happened? I mean, is that the case that Hitler used anti-Semitism to gain power, but then it wasn't really him that was driving the Holocaust, you know, in the death camps, it was his underlings. Or was it all a you know, propaganda piece from MI6? I mean, there are quotes from people in MI6 or MI5, the domestic spy agency in the UK. And there's, again, you know, who knows? We don't have the audio recording of these people saying things, but the quote is alleged. As the head of the MI5 guy, like, yeah, we should really be careful with this whole, like, gas chamber story because we're putting a lot of stock into it. And it might come back and bite us in the ass if we don't have the evidence to back up the claims that we're making. Is that a true quote? I don't know. Was it a story concocted by, you know, the British establishment?
I think it's well known and well accepted that for a good portion of the war, you know, we didn't know about those things, right? There are a lot of films, right, that show American men, you know, being recruited for the war effort because they want to kill the Nazi, fascist, Jew-hating, you know.
Right.
And it's like, eh, well.
Yeah, that was never part of it. Not only do we not know of it for the majority of the war, we didn't know any of it until after the war, right? There were no reports of death camps until the war was over. And the Soviets, you know, claim they discovered these. So it was never a part of like the pitch to the American people as to why we had to go to war. Now, it may have been the underlying reason, but the reason that was pitched was this is an inhuman authoritarianism that's, you know, sweeping the globe and it's completely antithetical to American and, English, European, Western, Christian culture to, you know, demand that everybody. And like it was, again, like you don't need to make this stuff up. You don't need to read propaganda story. Read literally any account from anybody that wasn't German, that was in Germany, Nazi Germany at the time. There are accounts of the American ambassador. There's a book called, I think it's called In the Garden of the Beasts. I believe it's all these accounts of the American ambassador and just like, and he's just complete. He's just like, every telephone is bugged. I can't go anywhere without a Nazi leering over my shoulder. If you're walking down the street and you pass somebody and they do the salute and you don't do the salute, you're liable to get beaten up by roving gangs of, you know, brown shirts or whatever they were called at that point. And it's just like, wow, it sounds awful. I don't know. I mean, you just read accounts of what it's like and you're just like, it sounds horrible. It's a surveillance state. Constant propaganda being shoved down your throat. You have to act like you're into it or else you get the crap beaten out of you. Like, no thanks. I don't want anything to do with that. Thank you, please. And that was the sentiment that was, you know, told to the American people that got us to fight a war. And of course you see it now. It's the same arguments they're making now against like Russia, where it's just like a strong man going in, imposing himself on a smaller state. We can't stand for that. I mean, all the arguments are there. So again, I mean, I guess we'll show you the video and get more into it. But again, you can't be afraid of this stuff. You can't like not contend with it. And you also can't just buy into it completely. Again, I don't know whether it's true or not that the primary funder of Hitler in the beginning was the Rothschilds, but that is what David Irving claims from firsthand, you know, immediate, sources. According to the prime minister of Spain at the time. It's like a letter between Churchill. And he's like, well, the number one funder for the rise of Hitler was the premier Zionist of Germany. Because again, they had, you know, similar designs at that point. They both wanted Jews out of Germany. Hitler didn't care where they went, and that person wanted them to, go to Israel to create the Zionist project. And that was the Rothschild banking combine. So it's like, you know, people act like, you're covering something up, but like that's what the history says. So how do you fold that into your understanding of the world? And what does that mean for how you interpret this stuff now? If you're anti-Zionist, if your whole thing is you actually like the Nazis because you hate the Jews, like how do you interpret the idea that the Rothschilds funded the Nazis? How does that play into your paradigm? Because to me, it's like, okay, that makes perfect sense. Actually, they're aligned by that. And, you know, as we know, and we see it today sort of relentlessly, is like anti-Semitism is very useful to folks like the Rothschilds who want to control Jewish people. And they want to go, hey, you're not German. Don't be German. Don't consider yourself a German person. You're something else. You're with us. All right. You're our people, not their people. Okay. And if the Germans are there going, but we love you and we want you to be a part of us. Yeah. It's kind of hard to make that argument. But if the Germans are saying, screw you, Juden, then it's like, see, we told you. Now you got to, give us your power. It's all just, manipulation of populations, Jewish and non-Jewish alike. It's a very convenient dichotomy for them to weaponize to achieve their ends. So, you can ignore that. You can just say, I don't believe that that's the case, in which case, all right. But I've seen evidence it's the case, so you got to interpret that along with everything else. Again, this gets it's hard to talk about because people are so sensitive about it and will take what you say out of context or will either, basically the dichotomy goes, people think either, they've come to a conclusion and they go, either you agree with me and my conclusion or you don't know what I know. And if only you knew what I knew, you'd come to the same conclusion I have. But if you do know what I know and you're still not come to the same conclusion, then you must be the liar. You must be on their side. You must be purposefully, pretending not to know this stuff so you can sell a lie. It's like, what if? Just what if I know everything you know? I've seen all the documentaries. I've read all the books. And I still don't think Hitler was a good guy. I still don't think Nazism is a necessary. That's how it's being pitched now. As if it's like, well, we got no other choice. Look how bad things are. Nazism, that's the only end. It's like, again, is this even the right? If that is even your goal, what is even your strategy? Like, that's what I don't even understand. I know it's like, even if I was on your side, I'd be telling you that this is not the right strategy for it. I don't know. All I know is when I look back to the Second World War, there's one person that I relate to more than any other, and it's Baron von Trapp. I'm Baron von Trapp over here. Just trying to avoid the Nazis, who apparently want me to play for their side, but I'm telling you, it's not the side, y'all. I'm an American. I don't kowtow to some little failed art student.
Just got in my methylene blue ultra. Methylene blue USP grade from thealexjonesstore.com. And I've heard all the rants and raves about this. I'm real interested to see how I'm going to feel. I'm going to do a third dropper and then some water right now. And I am going to see. Yeah, that's plenty. Maybe that's a little bit more. I'm going to mix this up. And pretty excited to see how this is gonna work. So after I fully drink this, I will let everybody know the effects of hopefully of what is the unlimited power. What's going on, Xers? Jay Rocket here. Just giving y'all an update. It's been an hour past doing the one dropper of the ultramethylene blue USP grade, the alexjonesstore.com. Currently at the gym right now, and it's hard to explain what I feel other than I do feel the mental clarity. I don't have any cloudy thoughts. My focus seems relaxed but very on point, and the energy kind of feels clean, no jittery things like that. I haven't really felt any tingling or anything. Maybe if I'll probably take an extra dropper next time. This is on an empty stomach as well. So definitely feel just cool, calm, and collected, but very focused, very centralized. It's a very calm zen feeling. So if you haven't gotten to try this stuff yet, you'll need to go to thealexjonesstore.com and get your methylene blue today.
Oh.
on here. I don't even want to make the joke. I don't even want to say it. All right, well, you know what we'll do? We're going to do your daily dispatch. We're going to do your daily dispatch in this first five, and then we're going to come back with some breaking news. Look, it has to do with chicken nuggets and Carnival Cruise, and you're just going to have to stay tuned for the full story. You're just going to have to stay tuned to find out what high C hijinks our fellow Americans are getting up to. We're going to move on because I got this giant stack of news I got to get to. And I got a lot of videos I want to get to. And I want to take your phone calls today. We'll see if we can get through everything we need to. Let's begin today, as we normally do, with our daily dispatch. All right. Here it is, folks. Your daily dispatch for Thursday, the 21st of August, 2025. Texas Republicans approve Trump-backed congressional map to protect party's majority. On Wednesday, the Texas House of Representatives adopted a new congressional map by an 88-52 vote, giving Texas Republicans five additional U.S. House seats and shifting the delegation from 25 to a potential 30 of 38. At the urging of President Donald Trump, Texas Republicans pursued a rare mid-decade redistricting to protect their narrow three-seat majority in the 435-seat U.S. House of Representatives for the 2026 midterm elections. The bill moves to the Texas Senate and then to Governor Greg Abbott, with a committee set to consider it and possible arrival by Friday after Republicans issued civil arrest warrants and $500 daily fines to compel absent Texas Democrats' return. The move has triggered a national redistricting war, with California Governor Gavin Newsom planning to redraw maps to add five Democratic seats, while other GOP-led states consider mid-decade redraws amid Voting Rights Act scrutiny. Now, if they want to start the war, I don't think we have any choice but to engage in it, and there are significantly more red states that are available for redistricting than blue states. So blue states are going to do it. I think red states need to as well. I think this is a failure of democracy at the end of the day. This is a total failure of our system, and our system should not be able to be gamed like this, but it is. And so you got to play the game or you're going to lose. And we'll return to what California is doing, but there's like 20 red states that could also do it. And I guess you should. Meanwhile, judge denies Texas Justice Department request to unseal Epstein grand jury transcripts. A U.S. judge has denied the Justice Department's request to unseal grand jury records that indicted Jeffrey Epstein on sex trafficking charges, stated the material is less significant than existing records the government holds on the case. Judge Berman emphasized that the Justice Department did not overcome the precedent to keep grand jury material sealed, and noted the sealed information is minor compared to the investigation file. And that's followed up by this story. House panel to make Epstein files public after redactions to protect victim identity. Records related to the investigation of Jeffrey Epstein will be released by the Department of Justice by the end of the week. The DOJ will provide Epstein-related records to the Oversight Committee on Friday. The release will include documents from Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking investigation, according to the Justice Department. So again, you've got various aspects of this. You've got the grand jury testimony. You've got the investigative records. Apparently, those investigative records are being redacted and will be given to Congress and released to us by tomorrow, I guess. So very excited for that. Meanwhile, Vance pushes Britain to abandon iPhone snooping powers. The UK government has abandoned plans to break into iPhones after U.S. intervention, leaving Apple's privacy system intact. Pressure from American President J.D. Vance has prevented British government agencies from overriding the privacy settings in Apple devices. It was revealed on Wednesday, the 20th of August. So that's very good. Tulsi Gabbard was also pressuring the UK to drop this, and there were even talks of using tariffs to get the UK to abandon some of its anti-free speech programs and policies, because we're America and we should probably be using whatever power we have in the world to progress our ideals, of which free speech is the bedrock. So I'm very happy to see America pressuring Europe to drop its tyrannical measures. And finally, we have this. At least 600 CDC employees are getting their final termination notice, union says. That's right, folks. You're getting their termination notices. Now, unfortunately, that just means they're being fired. But it is a major downgrade for the CDC. 600 employees being fired. I think they should be arrested.
Every guest we've interviewed in studio, I've given our ultramethylene blue to, and they've all been blown away. Ladies and gentlemen, this isn't hype. All our supplements are great and have amazing health effects, but this one hits 99% of people within 30 minutes, and the long-term effects are even more amazing. So secure your ultramethylene blue now, the most powerful you can get on the market, at TheAlexJonesStore.com, and fund the tip of the spear in the fight for liberty and supercharge your own personal life. Believe me, if you don't take action and get it, you will never know how amazing it is. Over 99% of people have had incredible effects. You owe it to yourself right now to try ultramethylene blue, exclusively available at TheAlexJonesStore.com.
You're tuned in to The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
All right, welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is The American Journal, brought to you, of course, by TheAlexJonesStore.com, TheAlexJonesStore.com/Harrison, if you want to let them know who sent you. We've got Bovine Colostrum Plus, the incredibly difficult to harvest, but not something that's available all the time, constantly, so we got to have a really good source for it. We have the best source for it, Cellular Recovery and Defense Matrix. It's Alex Jones Naturals Bovine Colostrum Plus, now available at TheAlexJonesStore.com. We also have Shilajit gummies that are on sale. I believe you buy one bottle of Shilajit gummies, the super-infused supplement that, again, just sounds like a... It sounds like a magical spell when you actually describe where this stuff comes from. It emerges from the top of the Altai Mountains, you know, in a process that humans have been utilizing for thousands of years, but we still don't really understand. It is a superfood tar that simply emerges from the earth. And people have been using it for its medicinal properties for thousands of years. We simply take it, purify it to the maximum degree. That's the thing. It comes out of the grid. It's like a tar that comes out of the ground. So it can have heavy metals, not ours. Ours has been totally, totally purified, totally cleared, totally just the core good minerals and vitamins and nutrients that, come from Shilajit. It's the same thing as the Irish sea moss. It's just these superfoods that like people have known about for 1,000 years, but have never been made available to you and to people around the world. So TheAlexJonesStore.com is where you go to get your Shilajit gummies, your Irish sea moss, your colostrum plus, and so much more. TheAlexJonesStore.com keeps us on the air and in the fight. Now here's the story. Here's the story, folks. Horrifying mass brawl breaks out aboard a Carnival cruise ship over chicken tenders. Okay. A cruise ship descended into chaos after a group of people on board got into an almighty brawl over chicken tenders. Video footage of the fight showed a group of several young cruisers throwing punches and knocking each other to the ground as onlookers crowded around to watch the chaos. Security guards made attempt to intervene as one turned away from the fight and reached for his walkie-talkie. Punches landed, shoes and phones flying across the floor. Many bystanders had their phone out recording the fight when one screamed, "Where the F is security? Where are they?" Mike Tara, who recorded the shocking footage and uploaded it to social media 2 days ago, flipped his camera while recording and said, "Over chicken tenders is crazy. It's crazy, y'all. Take evasive maneuvers." The exact details of the ship's name and the voyage on the video on which the video was filmed are unclear. Daily Mail has reached out to Carnival and Tara for comment. The brawl broke out around 2 a.m., according to Tara, who added the ship had set sail from Miami and it was an isolated incident. Just chaos. Chaos on the high seas. You know, it's like you got waves to worry about. You got sharks. You got storms. I mean, you're out there outside of the sight of land, you know, relying, trusting, incredibly complicated in some cases, very delicate systems keep you on life support. Why are you fighting over the chicken tenders? What are we doing here? Can we watch the video with some audio, or is that just not a good idea? Should we not listen to the audio? He said the fight was over more than just chicken tenders, but that really is the basics. I mean, if you want to get right down to the heart of it, it was about honor, okay? It was about honor and disrespect. It was about upholding one's honor in the face of thieves and disrespect. But it was actually just over the chicken tenders. Quote, I always hear Carnival is ghetto slash ratchet. I've been cruising for years, but this is the first time seeing some action on a ship I was on. Seeing some action. Sounds like he's like, finally. He's like, I keep going on Carnival cruises, hearing that they're ghetto and ratchet. This is the first time I've seen some action. Really got some excitement here at 2 o'clock in the morning over the chicken tender basket. Look, we need more details, okay? Video footage of the fight showed groups of several young cruisers. Is that what we're calling them now? Throwing punches and knocking each other to the ground on a Carnival cruise ship. Ship departed from Miami. The fight broke out around 2 a.m. The video was uploaded 2 days ago. You just see the image of this ship. And really, you know, there are very few things that, you know, can truly fill me with wonder at just the might of human engineering. I mean, when you see the size of these ships, I mean, you're talking about sending a city full of people in a metal husk across the ocean. And it's just amazing. I mean, you just see this, you're just like, wow, humans really are capable of incredible things. Up until now, humans have been capable of feats of engineering that are, you know, godlike in their scale. And there's something a little bit disconcerting. How do you put this? There's something off. There's something a little bit off about a race, the human race, that can both design the most astonishing and sophisticated marvels of engineering while we're still fighting over the chicken tenders. It's a little bit weird. It's a little bit nonsensical to me. Like you'd think you could have one or the other. But yeah, humans don't progress as one, I suppose. But you gotta think aliens are confused. You gotta be like, well, how are you people capable of going
to But it's an all you can eat buffet.
Well, let's find out. Let's get to the details here. One commenter wrote, Carnival must have some killer chicken tenders. Maybe that was it. Maybe they were just so delicious. The chicken tenders were so delicious, they made everybody go insane. Like, you think Chick-fil-A's good? Man, I started eating chicken tenders and Carnival Cruise. Next thing I know, I'm throwing a chair at a dude with a weave. It's crazy. You should taste these things. Maybe it wasn't the chicken tenders. Do they have a secret honey mustard recipe that they want to tell us all about? Quote, you wonder why they changed the rules, another said, referencing Carnival Cruise's recent changes, focusing on more adult-only atmosphere. Well, guys, we need the details. We need to figure this out. The security guard was like, heck no. Well, lo and behold, another Carnival Cruise looking like the circus it has truly become, another said. There is literally a never-ending supply of chicken tenders on the ship.
Like, if you've been on a cruise, you know that if you want more chicken tenders, they're there.
That's the funniest line of this entire article. Quote, there is literally a never-ending supply of chicken tenders on the ship. Please, please, people, we can get you all the chicken tenders you could possibly want. Stop ripping each other's hair out.
You ever think the captains of these ships, like when they bring them to port for the day, for like the destination, they just like want to just take right back off and just get the fuck out?
Just leave them? We're all disembarking at Kingston, Jamaica. We'll be leaving again at noon, and then at like 10:30, they're like, let's get the hell out of here.
Exactly.
Get the hell out of here.
Getting on out.
Look, I think you don't need to change the rules. What you need to do is inform the captains, this ain't your normal Carnival cruise. This is a wartime vessel now.
Maritime law's over.
Yeah, right. You're the captain. I think we need to bring back sort of the old school, like British Navy style. The captain is the supreme sovereign on the ship. I think that's what we need. That's what I'd love to see, is this scene that we're watching right now get broken up by an old white man with a white beard and golden buttons on his blazer, with the classic captain's hat, hands behind his back, just walking slowly through, and everybody stands up straight, knowing that if you catch him, you know, on bad behavior, you're getting keel hauled. All right. You see the size of these keels? I mean, keel hauling would kill you when they were dealing with little wooden ships that would fit within the dining room of these cruise ships. I say we bring back keel hauling. We can bring back keel hauling. We can bring back whipping around the fleet. That's an interesting one. That's where the sailors.
I have no idea what either of those are.
Okay, let me explain. Keel hauling is where you tie a rope around the entire ship. You tie the person to the rope, and then everybody hauls on the rope, and it drags the person under the water, and it basically tears them up because the barnacles on the bottom of the ship, and it almost drowns them.
Yeah,
and
by
the
time it's designed to kill.
Well, yeah, it was a punishment for doing things like this, for fighting over the chicken nuggets. So, you know, often in the annals of the Royal Navy, you'd hear, you know, these Napoleonic times. Have you ever seen Master and Commander? Remember the scene where they're all brawling over chicken nuggets?
I missed that one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just
But they do it there.
Bring it back old too. Now, whipping around the fleet, that was a different one. That's where a sailor would be flogged to near unconsciousness on his ship, and then they would go to every ship in the fleet, and he would do it again. And so you'd have, like, 20 times in a row that he was flogged to unconsciousness. So I'm just saying we have precedent. We know how to deal with insubordination at sea. It's called the cat of nine tails. Y'all want to hear some other? maritime punishments? I got more.
It is breakfast time.
Yeah. There is literally a never-ending supply of chicken tenders on the ship. Carnival needs to rethink minimum age requirements to board a cruise ship, another said. Well, that's obviously the issue. Is all of the children. I'm sorry, bring the video up again. There are no children in this video. What are you talking about?
They're all grown.
They're all grown adults at 2 a.m. fighting over the infinite supply of chicken tenders. All right. I shouldn't spend this much time, but I'm just saying.
Worth it.
Carnival has a zero tolerance policy towards any illegal substance and activity or disruptive behavior, according to its website. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the captain of these ships, they need to be ready at a moment's notice to take evasive action. Okay. Not to actually evade something, like they're not actually getting hit by a torpedo, but I think a good 90-degree turn would solve this problem real fast. I think a quick jerk of the wheel to the left and then to the right again real quick, and you send all these people tumbling into the wall, I think that's the way you solve this problem. I mean, I know they move kind of slow, but there's got to be something they could do. I don't know. I'm just thinking like a...
ram an iceberg.
I'm thinking like a dad here when your kids are fighting in the back of the car. A little tap of the brakes can go a long way. That's all I'm saying. You want to reset their attention. All right? Little brake check. sending everybody head over heels into the buffet. Suddenly everybody's a little bit confused as to what they were just fighting about.
Just think about it. Right? You would get everybody all frazzled. There would be at least one chicken tender within arm's reach of every person. Boom. Problem solved.
It could happen. Maybe like instead of water, like, you know, the sprinklers that go off if the fire alarm goes off. Could you rig that up with chicken tenders?
Like, no, hot sauce.
Or hot sauce. Like when a brawl breaks out, there's a little box on the wall. You break the glass and pull the lever and chicken tenders just start spraying everywhere.
Our suspense.
We're just brainstorming here. We're trying to figure out
chicken tender shooting robot.
Maybe
it can be done. It can be done, but at a cost.
There's a role for AI here. In April, Carnival banned 24 passengers who broke into a fight when disembarking the Carnival Jubilee. It was a disembarking. If you're done with the cruise and you're like, wait, we forgot to fight. Wait a second. The cruise is almost over and we haven't curb stomped each other yet. In an effort to curb some poor behavior from cruise growers, Carnival implemented a series of rules, including a 1 a.m. curfew for cruisers under 17 without an adult over 21. Carnival has a zero tolerance policy towards any illegal substance and activity or disruptive behavior, according to its website. Okay, here's the reason why it's worth it to spend time on this, because it is the perfect example of like our society where it's like, what is the point of going on a cruise? And is it not to have fun? Is it not to like not have worries, not have restrictions, eat as much as you want, drink as much as you want, no responsibility? It's literally not even an option for you to like do chores or like anything like that. Like you have to just have a good time. The whole point of you being there is to be have fun and be on vacation and enjoy yourself, right? And so it's like, okay, how do you stop people from fighting in that situation if people want to fight? You're going to lock everybody down. Like the way they're describing their like zero tolerance policy and like what's being implemented, I guess, as a necessity to deal with this persistent issue of people fighting on good Carnival cruises. It's like, okay, you're going to go on a cruise and it's like, all right, you've got to be in your bunk by 0700 hours and you're not allowed to leave until, and it's like, what is the point of this? Why even go on a cruise if you can't enjoy yourself, because anytime you let people enjoy themselves, they all start fighting and stealing chicken tenders from one another. It's a microcosm of why the American system needs some serious refurbishment, because it's the cycle we're in right now. People can't control themselves. They got to be controlled. If you can't stop the shoplifters, you got to put everything behind plexiglass. And if you can't be out at night and not start fighting with each other, then you all have to get locked into your cabins when the sun goes down.
I get where you're going with this.
Where am I going with it?
We got to put the chicken tenders behind plexiglass, duh.
Exactly. Exactly. America,
ration them out.
America is like an all-you-can-eat buffet. And if everybody just follows the rules and takes just what you can eat, then we can all enjoy our chicken tenders in peace. But the minute you start fighting over the chicken tenders, trying to grab all the chicken tenders so nobody else can have any, and people are going to start throwing punches, now we can't have an all-you-can-eat buffet anymore. Now we got to put the chicken tenders behind plexiglass. We got to have some sort of complicated ticket system where you get a ticket and you turn that in for one chicken tender.
And we've got a sprinkler system with an emergency brake that shoots hot sauce out.
There you go. Is that the world you want to live in, folks? Is that the world you want to leave for your children? America is an all-you-can-eat buffet. And unfortunately, a large portion of our population is trying to get all of the chicken tenders for themselves. Cruise ships are a shared space, and all guests are expected to treat others with respect. Well, maybe have more chicken tenders next time, genius. All right. The longtime family-friendly company announced its first adults-only cruise in November. They're like, these poor people. They're trying to implement these changes. They're really screwed. It's like, no, you can't, sorry, you can't have a budget cruise. So like, that just doesn't work. You have to have like some sort of filter that's like an, I don't know, there's no right now, as of now, there's no PCR test to determine whether or not you're the type of person to fight over chicken tenders. So there's got to be some other metric by which to judge people. I think it's got to be money. I think cruise expenses, I think if I was Carnival, I would just double my prices.
Problem solved. Your credit score must be this high to enjoy this ride.
There you go. Your social credit score must be this high. No, you're dead. You have to have a high credit score. It's like cruise ships for land-owning white males only. Just kidding. But you've got to have some sort of barrier to entrance, or else you're going to get brawls over the chicken tenders. So I say double your prices and this problem solves itself. I've never been on a cruise. I've always wanted to. They seem incredibly fun. I love everything about it.
They're all right.
Yeah. I mean, I love going to, you know, the Bahamas. I love the places that they go, but I also love the idea of trying to sneak down into the bowels of the ship, just see the engineering, see the scale of it all, maybe cause an international incident. And it feels like there's a lot of possibilities there on the high seas.
I just got to warn you. You know all those things that you explained to me that I didn't know about?
Yeah.
They know about those things.
All the punishments?
They know about every one of those.
All I'm saying is I see videos of cruises now, and I would never go on one. I mean, they just look awful. They look awful. And it's like, you know, you don't know whether your Carnival or your cruise is going to be like that or not, so why even take the risk? I don't know what Carnival's business plan is here. If it was me, I'd say double the price. Double the price of your cruise, and you'll get only people with immense disposable income that are making an investment to be on that ship, and maybe, just maybe, will be able to weigh the pros and cons in their minds and think, you know, I spent so much money on this trip. And there are, after all, infinite chicken tenders. Should I really fight over this one? Should I really throw a punch over this particular chicken tender? Is it that special to me? Or do I value other things more?
And the worst part about this story is that for anyone who has been on a cruise, we all know how good the chicken tenders are, and they suck.
I would assume so. I mean, I can't imagine.
Cruise food is literally the worst food. The stuff that they provide at the buffets is like trash, and they try to get you to buy, you know, meals from the nicer restaurants in the ship. That's the whole grift of the cruise. And so, but this to be going down, this is absolutely absurd. It's like literally on the level.
Literally America. It's literally just America. This is just what we're going through. You know, cruises, it'd be a nice thing if you could control yourself. It'd be a lovely adventure, a lovely experience to have, as long as you can, you know, resist the impulse to steal the chicken tenders or whatever the hell happened there. It's like America. We got a great thing going on here. People aren't constantly trying to take advantage of each other and rip each other's hair out. It would actually be nice. Please stop.
Every guest I have had in studio in the last 6 months, I've given our medical grade USP methylene Bluetooth. I don't even tell them what's going to do. I just say, here, take this, see what happens. Within 15 to 30 minutes, every guest says they've gotten energy like they've never experienced. Clarity, focus. It's like a fog has lifted. Their critical thinking goes to the next level. And that's what the science shows it does in our cells. It's not a stimulant, but it has that effect because it electrochemically turns up the literal electrochemical electricity in the body. And so he was here a few months ago, didn't know what it was, known me for a long time, said, sure, he'll take it. He heard Kennedy talk about it, RFK Jr. He took it, and it was so game-changing. In the last few months, he ran out of the bottle I gave him, so he wanted more. And the first thing he wanted was to take some more before we even went live on air. That's how amazing this is. You want to do the plug, and I appreciate this.
I do. I came in.
Because you came in saying, I want more methylene blue. And then I looked over when you went on the air. You'd already slurped some down. Your mouth was blue. I said, you're Papa Smurf. So, Patrick Byrne.
How much is the correct amount to put in? About that much?
Yeah. I mean, Kennedy does three droppers. This is really strong.
You gave me some last time. I think you gave it on air. You totally feel the difference. I used the bottle you gave me. It's great. It totally makes it. You can feel it. It just keeps your energy level up and plateaued without bonks. So I love it. I used the bottle you gave me, and I came back to Austin just to pick up this pump.
Well, you can always get it at theologyshow.com. It will certainly give you all you want. We also have the capsules, but we have the strongest medical grade. It's super good for you. It cleans out your mitochondria. Most people get instant energy, like 99% of people, but it's the workout. It's what does for your skin, your libido. So you've been on it a few months.
I just had that one bottle, but...
And you're saying no letdown. That's the best part. It's not an amphetamine. It's not a speed, but it feels like that.
I see RFKs on it. Yeah. I just used up that bottle. And so for a couple of weeks, I had this great energy, but it's not speed. It's not caffeine. It's nothing like that. It's doing something else for you. So I really...
Well, it skips three levels of the oxygenation process in the cells. It's just next level. It's incredible. And they've suppressed it. And my medical doctor 6 years ago said, get on it. And I said, get USP grade. It didn't do anything. And then our sponsor got this super strong one. I'm like, oh, let me try it. Whoa. I mean, it funds the operation, folks. But I'm telling you, if you haven't gotten our USP grade, real USP grade, Ultimethylene Blue, theoxygenstore.com, you are missing out. It is so good for you. 99% of people, it's more than that. Like, I've given it to like 400 people, maybe two or three didn't feel it. Some get totally freaked out that they're going crazy. So talk to your physician first. Take a very low dose the first time. You can't take it around SSRIs and other things. It is amazing. TheAlexShow.com. So,
It's not psychosomatic. It's not psychological. You feel it. You feel it.
Well, I didn't tell you what you were going to feel. How fast did it kick in and what did you feel?
I felt it by the end of the show. By the time I got, the last time I was here, I felt it probably by the end of the show or by the time I got my car. You feel instant energy, but without the jitteriness of caffeine and focus. What I felt was focus, mental focus. It's probably like why you are as intense as you are, Alex.
It's made me more intense. Well, I was taking full doses at first. And then working out so hard that, you know, I had to go.
You look jacked.
Well, I've cut back. The point is, I only take it every 3 days now because it's crazy. Everything we sell, I want is working and is good. That's what I want. I mean, I'll be like a restaurant. I'm going to serve dog shit to people. They're not going to come back. But I mean, this thing is the most dramatic, quick acting, and it's good for you. It's just insane. And if I could just get a few more percentage of the audience to buy it, all our problems would be solved. Patrick Byrne was totally blown away by it, as every other guest we've given it to has been blown away.
Watching The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch live right now at band.video.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I think it's about time we focus down now. Focus in on some of the stuff going on. There's a lot happening. And one of the things, actually, a story from yesterday that I may have to reprint. You know, I may put it in here today. Revolver.news had the rundown of how people are fighting back against H-1B visas. And it's actually extremely interesting. Essentially, you have prerequisites you have to fulfill before you can apply for H-1B visa employees. And the main one is that you have to try to hire American first. So the idea is that you're looking for some high-skilled job, of which there is not a huge pool of candidates. You put out, it's already in here. Okay. You put out, this is it right here. Yeah. Revolver.news. Fighting back. Americans flood the system and crash entire foreign worker pipeline. Okay. So, essentially H-1B, you have to put out an ad and try to fill it with an American first. And only when you prove that you can't find a qualified candidate can you go somewhere else? And that makes perfect sense, right? That's the way it's set up. It's the way it's supposed to be. It's the way it should be. You were just creating a country for the first time. You'd go, well, I want you to hire our guys. I want you to hire American. But if, you know, you're trying to do something great and your company is succeeding and you're hitting a roadblock, you can't hire the right person because there's nobody available. Like, okay, you can go somewhere else. You can poach the highest quality workers from other countries, come over here, contribute to us, right? The problem is, the problem is that these companies cheat. They lie. They technically fulfill just the bare minimum obligation for saying that they looked for American candidates and couldn't find any. So, I mean, they will do the most devious stuff. They'll put like an ad at the back of a physical newspaper in Idaho for 2 days and then go, well, we tried and can't find anybody, better go to India. They deliberately place ads where people will not see them so they can technically fulfill the obligation of, yeah, we did put an ad out. No, we definitely tried super hard, but in reality, they never tried at all. So it says, for years now, corporate elites and their buddies in the swamp have locked Americans out of good jobs by rigging the hiring system so cheap foreign labor can line their pockets. They built an underground pipeline that pretends to recruit U.S. workers while actually funneling the positions to cheap H-1B workers. The whole scheme runs on secrecy, red tape, and the government's flat-out refusal to enforce the law. But now, the jig is up. Americans have had enough and they're fighting back. Thousands of American workers are now flooding these rigged job postings and exposing the bald-faced lie that there are no qualified U.S. workers. U.S. workers are jamming up the PERM process, P-E-R-M process, exposing the big con and forcing the truth about the rig system out in the open. This is what it looks like when ordinary American workers finally fight back. Jobs.now has posted 3,800 plus job listings that companies, Meta, Stripe, etc., wanted to hide from Americans, and Americans have flooded them with applications. The number of Americans those companies have hired so far? Zero. They're openly violating the Immigration and Nationality Act because the Justice Department is refusing to enforce it. Jobs.now have posted over 3,800 job listings that were hidden, that were secret. So basically they're using AI to scrape all of the job listings everywhere and then reposting them on jobs.now. So Americans are going to jobs.now and they're seeing all these available positions that were being hidden from them on purpose because they don't want Americans to apply. The leaked HR post shows the real game at play. A company got 400 plus American applications for a perm track job. And instead of considering these workers, HR went into full panic mode and wanted to cancel the whole posting. Why would they do that? Well, simple, really. It's because if they go in and reject hundreds of qualified American workers, it'll trigger a Department of Labor audit. What does that really mean? It means they're using every trick in the book to not hire Americans, and they're using red tape as a cover to push through a green card applicant instead. And the reason we now know this is because Americans are applying en masse, so the paperwork theater is not working anymore. So here's the post. Employers say they can't file perm because they received 400 plus applicants for my perm job. He says, hi, everybody. I work for a small U.S. tech firm and we're in the early stages of a perm based green card sponsorship. HR posted my position and so far has received 400 U.S. worker applications and they expect roughly 600 total. HR is now telling me, quote, if we go through all 400 plus resumes and formally reject each applicant, it will flag us for a DOL audit and could put the entire company at risk. We're thinking of just canceling the posting. My direct manager, however, says he's willing to personally review every single applicant, document that none are qualified, and move ahead with the perm filing. The scale of this and the scale of this scam is pretty staggering, this article says. There are over 52,000 software engineer jobs set aside for H-1B visa holders and PERM. But here's the catch. If an American applies and is qualified, the foreign hire cannot be pushed through. That's why the postings are buried, the interviews are fake, the timelines are totally rigged. Everything is set up to make sure the American doesn't get hired. But now thousands of Americans are applying anyway, so they're blowing up the scam at its weakest point because the one thing the law is very clear on, U.S. citizens are supposed to come first. This is where things turn really rebellious. PERM rules require old-school Sunday newspaper ads. That's how the process was designed eons ago. Now, America First activists are telling American workers in places like Nashville to grab those papers, scan the job listings, and send them in. Because if real Americans actually apply, the companies can't claim the no qualified workers excuse. It's actually brilliant. They're beating corporate HR at their own game. The fight is and always will be about defending American workers against a system that's been rigged against them for decades. Now Americans are flooding the zone, breaking the bottleneck, and forcing the system to face what it's worked so hard to avoid, giving U.S. workers the jobs they want and deserve. So this is brilliant. I love this. I mean, I can't explain how happy I am this is happening, because it's one of these cases where I'm always sort of looking for stuff like this. It's not necessarily a protest, because as we know, most protests these days are ineffectual or fake, right? If it's a protest that actually stands against the establishment, they'll just call it hate speech or completely ignore it, or have a rival protest that they give more attention to and say, actually, this is what people really think. And you're not going to really achieve anything, because the people in power are genuinely not concerned with, like, they know. You go out and protest and go, hey, we don't want our kids being taught transgenderism in school. It's like, do you think they don't know that? You don't think they know that you don't want that? They're doing it to you because you don't want it. They don't like you. They hate you, and they're trying to destroy you. So telling you, invoking them, their empathy, and appealing to their goodwill is just not going to work. It's just not going to work. Now, it's not to totally downplay protests. It's an important role to play in our system. But for the most part, they're fake. If they're real protest against the establishment just ignores them. And if they're in hand with the establishment, then they just pay a bunch of activists to go out and pretend to protest for something so they can have the appearance of working for, you know, the democratic will, when in reality, it's all just fabricated in the first place. But this is beyond a protest. This is activism. This is direct action. This is, you know, interfering in their system and destroying it and overcoming it and manipulating it to your ends. I love it. I love seeing it. Somewhere else that I'm looking for things like this, and we're going to have on Tiffany Cianci tomorrow to talk specifically about things that you can do to stop BlackRock from, you know, using your retirement money to fund their ESG programs. Like, things that the average individual, the people listening to my voice right now, can go out, do something about, and make a change. I mean, this is a call to action right now. As just explained in that Revolver piece, revolver.news, fighting back, Americans flood the system and crash the entire foreign worker pipeline. You can do this. The way it's set up is, in order to get H-1B visas, they have to technically look for American candidates. The way they do that is they put ads in Sunday newspapers that nobody reads and nobody looks at. Here's what you can do. Go get your Sunday newspaper. Look at the ads. Send them in to jobs.now. They'll post them. People will apply. Now that company cannot get that H-1B visa because they have qualified applicants. And if they don't choose those qualified applicants, the Department of Labor will come in and audit them. That's amazing. That's beautiful. It's not a protest. That's an intervention. That is a, you know, commando mission against our enemies. I love it. You love to see it. And I encourage our audience to get involved in that, and use their own rules against them and stop them from taking advantage of the American system in order to screw the American people over. Now, I want to go to clip number two here, because this is along a similar line. And in fact, it ties into what we were talking about yesterday with the CDLs, the people who don't speak English and are illegal immigrants somehow getting commercial driver's licenses when they don't know how to drive a truck and they end up killing entire families. Do you know the guy that killed that family, right? He did a legal U-turn in an 18-wheeler. Caused a, you know, T-bone crash with a van full of an innocent American family. Do you know that supposedly, I don't have any confirmation of this, but supposedly that same guy, like, collapsed a bridge in, like, Vermont 5 years ago? Apparently this guy drove a 33-ton truck over a bridge only able to support 5 tons and just collapsed this historic bridge. And they just let him keep driving. Which, again, this is the danger. If you can't read the sign that says danger, you know, no trucks over 33 tons, if that all looks like gibberish to you and you drive your, I mean, it's just, this is absurd. We have people that can't read or speak English driving 16-ton trucks on our highways. What the hell are we doing? And this has been a problem for a while, but they actually have a way to solve this. Governor George Ryan of Illinois sold CDLs to trucking companies. A fraudulently licensed trucker then killed a family's 6 children. The parents survive. Ryan, this governor, was indicted and did 5 years in federal prison. Newsom's money gets laundered through NGOs, but it's no different. So again, so many things in this country today where it's like, this is just an obvious crime. Why are we not treating it as such? And especially stuff where you can go back in the past and like, this has already happened, right? They're giving CDLs people that should not get them. And then when those people with the CDLs are involved in crashes where they kill people, you're supposed to look back and go, who gave this person a license? And this is like the most normal thing ever, right? If you go to a doctor and he accidentally kills you, and then you look at his license and you go, wait, he never graduated medical school. Who gave him this license? You find out some dude that he paid $100,000 to fake a diploma for him. Like, dude, this is all a scam. It's all a giant fraud. It's a crime and you're the victim of it. So why are they not all being held to account? Again, we don't have, this isn't something new that we have to, like, why do you have licensing if this is how it's operated? So you've got Gavin Newsom as governor of California, as the head of the governmental body that dispenses CDLs, giving CDLs to people that do not qualify. This is not speculation. It's not like, well, he passed and he still crashed. No, these people, the test results we have from the guy that killed the family in Florida, he answered only 2 out of 12 questions and could only identify one street sign in the entire test. He should not have been given a CDL. But he was. Why was he? Now, in this case, it sounds like there was a kickback scheme. But it doesn't really matter. Truck driver accused on deadly Florida turnpike, crashed entering U.S. illegally. Yeah, so he shouldn't have a CDL. So who gave him one? Who gave him the paper that was to him a license to kill? And why are we not going after them? Let's go to clip number 2 here. Tie it all in together. This person posted this saying, a friend of mine went undercover and called one of the job ads from a Facebook group for truck drivers to find jobs. Let's watch.
I recently went undercover posing as a non-domicile, non-English speaking driver with zero experience to see just how easy and quick it would be to obtain a truck driving job in America. Now, the first thing I did is I went and I created a fake Facebook account, and then I typed in trucking jobs. And there's tons of Facebook groups just like the one right there that pop up. You join the groups, and right out of the gate, there's hundreds of posts like this right here. Assalamu alaikum, need Amazon drivers. Now, these Facebook groups are very, I guess you could say, utilitarian, because not only can you find these obscure non-domicile jobs, but you can also browse for active MC numbers with Amazon accounts already attached to them, so that you can just buy the MC number from somebody else, duct tape it to the side of your truck, and you're good to go. There's a whole black market on these Facebook groups selling MC numbers with active accounts. So have you screwed your MC number up? Has a driver went out and killed somebody under your MC number? That's okay. Just get on this Facebook group and you can buy another one, print it off, and duct tape it to your door, and then show up at Amazon and you can still haul their freight for them. Perhaps even you're looking to sell an MC number with an active Amazon account. You can do that also. Now, moving forward with the process, we're about 5 minutes in now. I reached out via text message to this phone number right here. I simply said, are you still hiring for Amazon driver? A short time later, I got a phone call, and that phone call was a guy who I personally could barely understand. I was trying to emulate an accent the best that I could to remain cloaked. And the very first question they asked, which was the deciding factor if they would hire me, was, where are you from originally? I couldn't say I was from America, so I lied and I said that I was from India. They then took my information and I got a phone call back shortly thereafter, and it was a 3-minute phone call with the guy who was sort of the head honcho over the entire operation, who told me it was totally okay that I don't have experience, that's not going to be an issue at all, and that they would be happy to put me behind the wheel of a truck regardless of circumstances. But just wait, they actually informed me that they don't just do Amazon, they also do FedEx and USPS. They contract for those as well. Now, if you're a truck driver or if you travel the interstates often, you guys know that Amazon, FedEx, and USPS is sort of the trifecta of misery that we all see being at the scene of each one of these massive wrecks where there's multiple people losing their lives when a non-domicile driver crashes into somebody.
And it happens over and over. So, I mean, why are we allowing this? Why are we allowing this? Why are we allowing people to screw our system over like this? It would be bad enough if they were just screwing the system over, but they were all great drivers. But they're killing people. And here's a story again from Revolver.News. Chilling update in case of Indian truck driver who killed three on Florida Turnpike. They report this illegal truck driver made a reckless, unauthorized U-turn that turned deadly and killed three innocent people in the blink of an eye. But it wasn't just some tragic accident. It was totally preventable. And what went down raises deeper questions about who's being allowed behind the wheel of these massive semis that are traveling across American roads. And again, the crappiest thing about this is that the trucking industry is one of the main ones that'll be replaced by AI before anybody else. So, like, they don't even care that this is happening because their ultimate plan is to replace truck drivers with AI anyway. And so the greater number of disasters and tragedies that happen with 18-wheelers wrecking, that just boosts the argument for AI drivers. They don't actually care about trying to prevent this because the tragedies contribute to their overall goal of, going on. Humans are just too untrustworthy. I guess humans are just too untrustworthy. I guess we have to have AI now. But here's the part that'll make your blood really boil. This may not be the first time this illegal truck driver has wreaked havoc on U.S. roads. In fact, the man is the very same as another Indian truck driver responsible for collapsing an 88-year-old bridge in Arkansas just a few years ago. If y'all can pull up this article, it actually has the picture of it. Wonder if the illegal immigrant that killed three people was the same Harjinder Singh that destroyed a bridge in Arkansas 5 years ago by negligently driving his truck over it. And again, you got a 33, where there it is, yeah. So this historic 88-year-old bridge that just clearly could not handle an 18-wheeler and had a sign saying as much, but the guy didn't speak English, so he drives right over and collapses an 88-year-old bridge and probably costs, you know, the city millions of dollars to have to fix it and repair it and save him and, you know, whatever load he was hauling, you know, went away. And then they just are like, well, tough luck, buddy, get back in another truck. Yeah, get to it. I get, you know, once you kill a family, then we'll step in. But as long as you're just collapsing bridges and causing traffic jams and acting like an idiot, I guess there's nothing we can do.
You know, I've got an anecdotal story and, you know, I was moonlighting and doing an event here in town, and you know, a lot of these AV events, right, that you need, you know, professional equipment for, have 18 wheelers that, you know, a couple of them for a show, something like that, not uncommon. The driver who came to pick up you know, a lot of the gear, the, you know, engineer on site and everything recognized right away that the guy was super green because he was not down with using any type of load bar or, you know, strapping equipment down inside the trailer of the truck. And, you know, it was funny because the guy was going all the way back to California to the warehouse with all this gear and talking better part of $500,000.
Right.
Right. In the trailer. Guy goes, yeah, it's just a short journey, no worries.
To California. Like
the second you leave my this load bay, you are responsible for all this gear, so, you know?
And that's, again, that's the thing. It's like, I said it yesterday, but like, okay, you know, your family might not be killed by an Indian truck driver. God willing, I hope you all avoid that fate, genuinely. Like, your life's going to get worse. I mean, how many little tiny, you know, inconveniences are piling up by the millions day after day that just make your life just a little bit worse. You're sitting in traffic just a little bit longer. You're paying just a little bit more to cover just a little bit higher insurance. You wait at the hospital just a little bit longer. Just a few more people in there that wouldn't be there otherwise. But just, you know, these things pile on top of each other one after another. A million a day for years on end. And it's like, okay, well, that's why we're falling apart. These little shortcuts, these little instances where people go, that's not how I would do it, but I guess he's the one responsible. It's just crazy, man. It really is. Yes, many wondered if this was the same man that caused the deadly crash in Florida. This bridge collapse happened in 2019, January 30th. the Yell County of Arkansas, Yell County town of Ola, Arkansas. Singh was reportedly hauling a load of processed chicken to Danville. My God, the chicken nugget menace returns. Maybe that's the issue. Can we have a total and complete ban on chicken nuggets until we figure out what's going on here? We got truckloads of chicken nuggets getting driven into rivers. We got Carnival cruises collapsing into chaos over chicken nuggets. What's in these chicken nuggets? What are we doing here? How is it that we've got two different stories that we have? Okay. All right. Just saying, when they call it, what do they call it exactly? Processed chicken. It's chicken nuggets. The guy was handling chicken nuggets. He had 6 tons of chicken nuggets. Or no, there were signs posted at the bridge entrance warning the driver about the 6-ton weight limit. Singh attempted to cross the river anyway in his 38-ton truck. Limit was 6. His truck weighed 38 tons. And he thought, yeah, it'll probably be fine. The man driving that semi either couldn't read the sign or flat out didn't care. And yes, many wondered if it's the same man that caused the deadly crash in Florida. Well, we can now report that according to India Times, it is in fact the same man. They did the dot connecting work. That's kind of racist. Look, we're connecting the dots, okay? The ones in their foreheads. They explicitly state that the Florida driver is the very same Harjinger Singh that caused the Arkansas Bridge collapse in 2019. He's working for U.S. CityLink Corp. If this story feels a bit like deja vu, that's because we've been warning about this issue for a while now. Foreign truck drivers, many of whom are here illegally, are being handed CDLs like Halloween candy, even though they clearly don't know our language, our laws, or even basic trucking safety. It's not just about one reckless driver named Harjinger Singh. It's about a systemic breakdown that's flooding our highways with unqualified foreigners behind the wheel of 40-ton death machines. An American trucker says illegal, possibly Jamaican or Haitian, are being given commercial driver's license even though they can't speak English and have no idea how to operate a truck. He claims they don't know basic things like how to read a scale ticket or how to set up their rigs. Other drivers claim California is handing out CDLs to illegals who can't even read street signs. And that apparently is what happened to Singh. So again, go back in history, a former governor of Illinois was arrested for this and spent 5 years in prison for this exact crime, giving CDLs to unqualified truck drivers who went on to cause deadly crashes. It's exactly what's happening here. Donald Trump, throw Gavin Newsom in prison. You have the precedent. I'll bring it up again. Governor George Ryan of Illinois sold CDLs to trucking companies. A fraudulently licensed trucker then killed a family 6 children. The parents survived. Ryan was indicted and did 5 years in federal prison.
You were just telling me that you had a brain disease, and what did you do to fix it?
I found this guy's a functional medicine guy, and he got me on methylene blue, and that instantly stopped everything.
I'd take it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I take it every day as well. And
yeah, RFK Jr. told me about it.
Yeah, man, it's fantastic. And so this guy's injecting in 1890, injects these rats with it, and then does an autopsy on these things. And their brain, the brainstem, every single nerve is blue. So he discovered this methylene blue has an affinity for neuronal tissue. So he says, well, it's sucking into neurons and working in the body. So we started putting it in humans. And we found out it's an MAOI, which helps with depression and anxiety and all kinds of life stress and stuff. It is so incredible that it acts as an electron donor to mitochondria, especially your neuronal mitochondria. So it helps you produce more ATP, and it helps you get rid of this stuff called reactive oxygen species. So you have an oxygen molecule that should have 2 hydrogens on it, and like your body's job is to convert stuff into water so you can pee it out. So if you get an oxygen molecule, it's got 4, 5, 1, it's a reactive oxygen, which we call free radicals. So methylene blue goes in there and balances a lot of those things out in your brain and your nervous system. So it is a miracle, and it's been proven for 100 years. That's one of the most well-proven drugs out there.
The strongest medical-grade methylene blue. And this is what I'm on. Total mitochondria cleaning. Next level energy. This is amazing. And you want to know what I'm on? Iris CMOS Shilajit. This right here. Look at that. That is power. I'm on intermittent fasting. I'm 8 to 3 o'clock today. And I stopped eating crap food, stopped drinking. That's what I'm on right there, baby.
All right, so we got some breaking news here. Russia bombs U.S. factory in one of world's largest war's largest attacks. Russia struck an American business with cruise missiles overnight in one of the largest aerial attacks in the war so far, Ukraine has said. The Ukraine Air Force said some 574 drones and 40 missiles were fired overnight, primarily targeting western regions of the country far from the battlefield's front line in the east and south of the country. The strikes killed one person and injured 15 more and struck a major American electronics manufacturer in the city of Mukachevo in Zakarpattia, according to Andriy Sybiha, Ukraine's foreign minister. The video footage showed a large fire at the premises of Flex Limited, a multinational firm that has its headquarters in Texas. The company manufactures electronic goods, including game consoles, laptops, and control units for cars and other vehicles. The bombardment was Russia's third largest aerial attack this year in terms of the number of drones fired and eighth largest in terms of missiles. Poland scrambled aircraft to protect its airspace during the overnight attack on Lviv, which is less than 50 miles from the Polish border. Warsaw said it saw no violations of its airspace. The assault came just days after Putin traveled to Alaska to meet Trump to lay out his terms of peace, which included Ukraine withdrawing from the entire Donetsk region. Zelensky, the Ukraine president, said the attack was carried out as if nothing were changing at all. This scum. I mean, what is there more to say about Zelensky? Scum, man. Right? Because his whole thing is he tried desperately to stop the peace talks from happening. Right? The day before the peace talks, Ukraine launched the largest drone attack they ever had. He's meeting in the UK, trying to shore up funding from European leaders to signal to Russia that even if America wants us to fold, we're not going to fold. We're going to keep fighting. He hears the demands from Russia after the peace conference and comes out and says, absolutely not. There's no way. In fact, he says, the Constitution forbids me from surrendering land to Russia. It'll never happen. Russia's like, okay, here are some bombs. And they're like, what? But you're acting like nothing has changed. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Absolute scumbag. My God. It's like, if you want there to be peace, why are you doing everything in your power to facilitate the war and continue the war? And then when the war continues, you can't then cry foul and say, oh my gosh, it's like Putin isn't even trying for peace. He said Moscow had shown no signs of pursuing meaningful peace negotiations and urged Ukraine's allies to respond with stronger pressure, including further sanctions and tariffs. The American business located in the city of Mukachevo has 600 workers inside. The attack sparked large fires and injured 15 people. The White House previously said its mineral deal with Ukraine would protect the country as Moscow would not dare attack American investments. So again, it's just Putin re-emphasizing, he's like, I don't need to do peace. I am winning. I could destroy Kiev. I could take over all of Ukraine. I have and will continue to advance into the country, so make peace. Zelensky does everything he can to scuttle peace talks and then cries foul that peace hasn't been achieved. And some new information has dropped. We don't have any confirmation about this, but it does align with basic observation. Ukraine's military losses exposed, 1.7 million dead and missing. Russian hackers have reportedly breached the Ukrainian General Staff's database, revealing catastrophic losses of the armed forces of Ukraine. According to the compromised digital registry, if the data is correct, Ukraine lost 721,000 troops killed or missing over 3 years of the conflict. The breakdown
is this: 118,000 in 2022, 405,000 in 23, 595,000 in 24, 621,000 in 25, the heaviest year yet, and we're just a little over halfway through. So I'll bring you more information about this, but according to Trump, he has been saying for a while that millions are dying in this conflict, and these numbers seem to correspond with that, which is horrifying.
Hey, Chase, good to talk to you again. I wanted to do a quick plug on the methylene blue, on the long-term effect that it had on me. Back in 2020, I got COVID. My brother and my dad both have eczema. After I got COVID, it must have, it opened that dormant cell in my body or whatever. So I've been dealing with eczema ever since 2020. And the long-term effects of the methylene blue, 99% gone.
That's absolutely incredible. I'm so happy. Have your relatives tried it too to see the same effect?
I have been trying to get my brother to take it and he's skeptical, but I'll tell you what, I got four bottles sitting on my table. I think I'm just going to give him one. And I think if I just give it to him, I think he'll eventually try it.
Yeah, that's a good move.
You're tuned in to the American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at band.video.
All right, welcome back, folks. I'm looking for a post from the red-headed libertarian who responded to this leak of the Ukraine death numbers. She did the math, apparently, and I could just paraphrase it, which looks like I might have to do since I'm having trouble finding it. But essentially, she broke down the demographics of Ukraine. It was basically like, you know, according to the official census, the number of adults aged 18 to 35 in Ukraine is about 1.7 million. So it's like, okay, so basically literally an entire generation of Ukrainian men have been killed. Like, except for the people that fled the country, these numbers are to be believed. Pretty much every Ukrainian man, 18 to 35, like people born between whatever that would be, 2007 and 1989, have been killed in this war. For George Soros and Victoria Nuland's ambitions. For Zelensky's self-serving considerations. In fact, we can go to a video here. It's the whole thing's very long. Or no, okay, it's not that long. All right, I misread the numbers. Clip 16, Owen Schroyer posted this yesterday. It's that's why Zelensky keeps the war going. And it's just a montage of all of the gigantic houses owned by all of the Ukrainian oligarchs. I misread the timesheet. I thought it said that this video was 9 minutes long, and frankly, I wouldn't even have been surprised. I would not be surprised if you could make a 9 minute long montage just showing the immense wealth that the Ukrainian oligarchs and leadership and warmongers have accrued to themselves from our tax dollars. Let's go to clip 16 here. What is corruption? It asks. And these are all of the various members of the Ukrainian government and their very sizable houses all over the world. And they look very nice. They look totally untouched by war. Looks like this might be a reason that they're not so concerned about trying to end the war so quickly. They can keep going a little longer. They can rake in a little bit more cash. And there have been stories. Frankly, we just have no idea. It's sort of like the mail-in ballot situation where it's like, yeah, we can assume that the money's going missing. It's just the way that the funding mechanism is set up, it is impossible to know whether the money's going missing. In the same way that, yeah, you can audit the mail-in ballots, but at the end of the day, the system is so corrupt, it's so broken on purpose that you can never actually verify whether or not a count is official or fake. So that's basically how the Ukraine conflict has gone down, is the money is just given in cash to a large degree, and it just disappears. And the Ukrainians go, no, we definitely spent that on weapons. And then they show up with a new yacht. Each record released by these Russian hackers contain names, circumstances, and locations of deaths or disappearance, personal details, family contacts, and photographs. The hack was carried out by a group including Killnet, Palik Pro, UserSec, and Berengini. The hackers now hold terabytes of sensitive material, full loss registries, personal data of Ukraine's Special Operations and Intelligence Command, as well as lists of all foreign arms suppliers and weapons delivered from 2022 to 2025. And so again, the horrifying breakdown is that 1.7 million men have died just from Ukraine in this war. Once again, this is very much aligned with what Donald Trump has said when he's speaking extemporaneously about the figures he's seen. And the question once again is, for what? For what purpose and why? And of course, we've seen video after video of the Ukrainian recruitment officers grabbing people off the street, grabbing fathers out of their homes, hauling them away, sending them to the front line to be drone fodder in this World War I style trench warfare madness, whose ultimate result was inevitable and a foregone conclusion from the outset. Y'all remember really early on when Russia bombed a dam and it caused a bunch of flood water to go sweeping across these World War II battlefields? And in like the first week of the Ukraine war, you had thousands of human skulls emerging from the ground wearing SS helmets. Y'all remember that? Remember when God gave us a very clear sign as to what lies at the end of this road? I do. I remember that. Skulls left scattered after Ukraine dam breach, maybe from Second World War. And I made a big deal about this at the time. I'm a romantic. I look for signs. I try to read, I try to read the signals, the omens that God is presenting us with. And to me, when you have a war begin, and one of the first things that happens is you have thousands of human skulls that have laid buried and unknown for decades emerging from the earth like zombies, like undead skeleton monsters reaching up from hell to tell us, stop doing what you're doing. I mean, look at that. Look at that. The SS helmet on the head. Buried for 80 years, only in this symbolic moment to reemerge. The ghost of the war in the past warning us of what's ahead. Craziest ones where the mouth is open. It's like angled up. It literally looks like it's a skeleton desperately clawing its way up from the grave. But hey, you know, Victoria Nuland wanted that merit badge on her Girl Scout sash. So that's what this is all for, I guess. You know, George Soros is pissed he can't turn little Russian boys into girls. So, you know, sorry, Ukraine. All right, we'll move on. I do have some more to talk about that, but we'll move on. The military is preparing attacks on Mexican cartels. The Trump administration has directed the military to prepare for lethal strikes against cartel targets inside Mexico, three military sources tell us. The top secret planning order issued late spring directs Northern Command, NORTHCOM, to manage the attack plans, which are ready by mid-September, or to be ready by mid-September. Though U.S.-Mexico military relations are broad and cooperative, any military action south of the border is considered extremely sensitive for both Washington and the Mexican federal government and is rarely discussed in public. Not only is Donald Trump uniquely focused on TCOs, transnational criminal organizations, the official name for cartels, having designated them terrorists in one of his first executive orders, but he's shown himself to be willing to take unilateral action despite potentially negative political ramifications, said one intelligence official. He and the other sources say that the military action could be unilateral, that is, without the involvement or approval of the Mexican government. The unprecedented order was discussed at a July meeting at NORTHCOM headquarters in Colorado Springs. Today, more than ever, the challenges we face demand a joint, coordinated, and adapted response, Morales said after the Colorado visit, trying to impress upon Pentagon and military leaders that any potential operation be conducted by the two nations together. The problem is that the cartels, in many cases, out-arm the Mexican military. So what are you supposed to do? We talked about this forever. When you have a country, ostensibly it has a civilian leadership, it has a government. But what happens when the government is weaker than the cartels? What happens when you, as the government, try to go and arrest a cartel leader, put him in jail, and then the cartels show up in tanks, rip the doors off the jail, haul the guy away, and leave your soldiers dead on the ground behind them? Are you really in charge? Are you really the government? Or are the cartels just allowing you to play government as long as it doesn't interfere with their business? And so what does that mean? What that means is that our most immediate neighbor to our south is basically a group of terrorists. I mean, it's a group of criminal networks. It's not actually a government. The government is there just as long as and in so much as they serve the cartels. But if they get in the way of the cartels just beat them up and kill them. Do what they want anyway. So that's the actual power in Mexico. You can vote for whoever you want. The Constitution can say whatever it wants to say. If you don't have the power to arrest a cartel leader, because the cartels outnumber you, outgun you, and have more influence than you, then you're just some dude, right? You're just some guy wearing a badge. But like, it doesn't actually matter. You have no actual power, and the actual authorities in that area are the cartels. So that's who runs Mexico. Just so we're clear. And so, like, we have to do this. And not only do we have to do this because Mexico is literally incapable of doing this for a variety of different reasons. Not only are they outgunned, but like, the people in positions of power in Mexico are paid off by the cartels and will not move against them if they themselves don't want to have their families assassinated, their heads chopped off with a chainsaw, and their dead body hung over the local overpass. You know, that's what it's like outside of America. NORTHCOM is already involved in Mexico in a host of ways, including combating the cartels. General Gillot alluded to this in his recent testimony to Congress, where he said cooperation with Mexico is already closer than at any point in history. But Mexico is resisting this, and the Mexican government is going out and telling Mexicans in America to resist deportation and to organize politically against things like tariffing expropriations, or, you know, tariffing the money that's sent to Mexico. So, you know, at a certain point, we just got to do what we got to do. America is our cartel. I was sort of explaining this the other day when we were talking about Washington, D.C. and all these criminal gangs that are operating there. And a lot of libertarians, you know, it's a big libertarian or anarchist talking point that, like, we don't have a government. We just have a mafia. We have a mob. We have a bunch of gangsters, you know, sitting on top of us and telling us what to do. And like, yeah, you're right. That is what governments are. That's what gangs are. What are gangs other than just, you know, like-minded associated people who agree to have each other's back? And the reason you have gangs is for self-protection and for imposition of power on others. Right? Well, you would join a gang because you live in a dangerous neighborhood and you go, gee, somebody could kill me and get away with it. But if I join up, if I join the Crips, if I join the, you know, TDA or whoever, then those people won't kill me because my boys will go get them. It's a form of protection. So it's a shield. It's the same reason we have a government. It's just instead of being predicated on, you know, pure physical power, we've actually elevated and we're able to use our human intelligence and enlightenment ideals and actually establish governments that theoretically justify themselves beyond the use of force. But at the end of the day, that is what they are. Now, you can not like that all you want. You can not like that the sky is blue. You can really think that purple would be a better color. Think that all you want. My friend, it's the sky's blue. So, and governments are gigantic gangs. The reason that's not a bad thing, the reason I'm not against that, is because that's my gang. That's the whole idea, is that the government is our gang. It's our cartel. They're our friends that will look out for us. We've got all these little cartels. We've got all these little gangs running around acting like they're big shots. I want my gang to put them in place, put them in their place. So I that's how everybody should think about their nation. That's why I'm like a nationalist. It's like, this is my gang. These are my people. And when you mess with one of us, we're going to stomp you into the dirt because we're stronger than you and we're better than you. We're smarter than you. We have better weapons than you. We have more money than you. Why would you mess with us? And I felt that personally when I went to Mexico as a cameraman with Ben Swan, and we were investigating the disappearance of protesters that had been disappeared by the Mexican government. A bus full of school-aged student protesters disappeared by the Mexican government. We went down there to investigate it, and at times we were being followed by the federales, and we had to lie on our, you know, visas to get in, because if they would have known what we were investigating, they wouldn't have let us. So part of me was kind of nervous, like, oh, geez, here we are in Mexico under the authority of the Mexican government. And sort of for the first time in my life, I was like, man, it feels really good to be American right now, knowing that if Mexico tries to do something to me, the American government is going to have my back. Now, maybe that was wishful thinking, but that is how it's supposed to work, and that is generally how it works. To where if I, as an American, go down to Mexico and the Mexican government arrests me or my family can't get in contact with me, the U.S. government goes, hey, you have that's our friend. He belongs to us. You're messing with him. You're about to unleash hell on yourself. So give us our boy back. Isn't that cool? Isn't that a cool thing to have at your disposal? Just by sheer fact of your inclusion in this exclusive club, what it means to be an American. Again, why it's so infuriating that we just give this away to total strangers, have never contributed to it, and in fact are just weakening us and, you know, taking advantage of our offer of help. So when you strip away all of the ceremony and pomp, what you're left with is the very simple fact that we're all part of different gangs. And for most of us, for me, I want Trump to be our gang leader to go impose our will on other gangs and protect us from the actions of other gangs. So these cartels are just chumped up children when compared to the awe-inspiring might of the United States and our military. So why we let them take advantage of us at all is just a choice we're making. It's just a mercy that we're showing them that they don't deserve and haven't ever even asked for. So I'm for it. So I say go to war with the cartels in northern Mexico and free the people of Mexico from them. Hell, if we really wanted to help the Mexican people, we'd conquer them. Actually, I think they, for the most part, vast majority of Mexicans would probably appreciate having America come in and put, you know, an American governor over them, because America believes in our system and doesn't constantly undercut it. As we've explained a million times, and is just, I just talk to a Mexican person if you have any questions about this. Do you understand that, like, in Mexico, everybody takes bribes about everything all the time? And it's just a part of their culture. It's a part of their system. That's just, it's called the bite. And it's just an understood thing that people in power are corrupt. They all are. And so if you can pay them off, you're going to be treated nicely by them. And if you can't, then you're on your own. And I wish if I could just impress one thing on the American people, it's like, why are you under the impression that, like, everywhere is like America? Nowhere is like America. Nowhere in the world. And America is not even like America anymore. Because the more we become not America, the more we welcome other people from other parts of the world. These guys just got busted, stuff in mailboxes. All these Muslim guys in Hamtramck, or however the hell you say that name. Have you ever talked to anybody about, I had another video, I'll never be able to find it here. Well, it was a video of a candidate for mayor in India. And he's driving through the city and he's filming himself. He's got somebody there filming him. He's in the backseat of a car, the window's down, and he's handing out cash as he drives through the neighborhood. And outside is a crowd of people all clamoring to try to grab cash. And it's like, he's not hiding it. He's not doing this, you know, secretly. Because this is the way their system works. The average Mexican's most frequent brush with the system is the mordida, the bite. Those are small bribes, tips, and other extracurricular handouts that public servants and others squeeze out of the citizenry to perform routine functions. It sounds like hell. Bureaucracy already is hell. Imagine if you had to pay for the privilege, right? Imagine if going to the DMV wasn't bad enough already. You got to shell out $20 to the dude behind the counter because his cousin got him the job. It's just like, that's what the rest of the world is like. And I mean, Europe is like that too. You ever been to Italy? They just try to screw you over constantly. It's just scam after scam after scam, which is why they pay just as much in taxes as the Germans do, but their trains are crap and the German trains are perfect. It's like, you got these different mindsets of people that are not equal. They're not the same. They're not both fine. No, one is good and one is not. The American system is good. It was good. It's supposed to be good. You're supposed to be able to give people power knowing in full confidence that they won't abuse it. That just because they could force you to pay $20 to get your driver's license, they're just not going to do that. Because they understand that that $20 they get now is not worth the societal destruction they're sowing in the process. That getting this little benefit now for yourself in a selfish way is not better than being honorable and contributing to a society where we can all understand the rules and not be screwed over by one another and not feel the need to screw other people over because you're being screwed over. It's just why are we moving away from the system that we once had towards this system that is just worse in every possible way? Because bad people don't want you to be upstanding. Evil people don't want judges that aren't corrupt. The evil people want the corrupt judges so they can get away with stuff. The corruption is there to facilitate the evil. Anyway, we should go to war with the cartels.
All the guests, dozens of them that have taken it, within 45 minutes to an hour, have varying degrees from extreme energy and feel really great, to fog lifting, to just over the top crying and feel so good. Cleans out the cells, just does incredible things. RFK Jr. loves it. We've got the strongest old wrestling blue. But he's going on Owen in about 30 minutes. My show just ended and I forgot to do this. Don't forget when he's on Owen to tell us what he felt. And if he doesn't feel it, we'll put that out. So stir it, go ahead and take a half dropper or so. That's about a half dose. And then go ahead and shut that down. and then we're going to find out what happens to you. We'll see. Most people initially live about 30 minutes, start speaking after a couple hours, but just tell people what you think, and if you don't feel it, we're going to tell everybody.
20 minutes later.
I can feel a definite, like, an energy spike. Yeah, it feels pretty good.
What are you going to do now? Now that you have your energy spike?
I'm going to see if it has a crash.
I've never heard of a crash.
Yeah, apparently it doesn't. But yeah, it feels pretty good. Yeah, definitely, I feel sharper.
Okay.
Yeah, I was pretty tired coming in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
well, you're running around Texas right now. You're dealing with some other issues here.
I was driving all over Texas giving speeches for True Texas Project.
So did he give you the drink or the capsules?
I took the drink, but I got a bottle of each, and I'm going to go and do a longer-term test. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah, I do feel kind of amped right now. Yeah.
Several weeks later.
You just saw an ad for Methylene Blue. You were here a few weeks ago. And I do this with every guest, more than 50 of them now. Every person has had clarity, energy, a fog lift is the most common. But what's really good is the long-term effects for your stamina, your energy, your libido, your how hard you can work out. It's amazing. So I had forgotten when he was coming in, we gave him a bottle because he loved it.
Almost gone.
I had forgotten to ask you if you listened to it long-term. So just briefly, tell people the short-term effect and then now a few weeks later, the long-term effect.
Yeah, it gives you a good energy boost. I use it before I work out. So if I'm going to be doing kettlebell workouts, like I do some Methylene Blue about a half hour before, and it just gives you mental focus. I don't crash afterwards. That's good stuff. I need some more.
We'll give you some. How fast did it kick in?
About 15, 20 minutes. I take about a half hour before my workout.
And then you're saying you're almost out of the bottle. Was that 3 weeks ago, a month ago?
Something like that. You give me the liquid and the pills, too.
You're almost out of both?
Yeah, I'm almost out of both.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all right. I'll give you more. Right. For the audience, we can't give it to everybody. We need your support, thealtruistwork.com. For me personally, the first week I got on it, now 4 or 5 months ago, I actually started to hurt myself because the workouts were so crazy. My trainer goes, dude, what's going on? Like 3 days into it. I go, I don't know. I was like lifting way more, going way harder. And then I got really exhausted after about a week because the same thing happened to Rob Dew, who's a great long distance, bike rider. So he's quite the athlete. He said he was biking so hard up hills and stuff that he actually had to pull over because, his heart was going crazy. I mean, this stuff's wild.
Yeah, it's good. I like it better than doing like a 5 hour energy shot because those will make you crash afterwards. This doesn't have the crash.
So you've had no crash.
Right.
It's not a stimulant. It just skips the oxidization process somehow.
So I've been using it while I'm out there doing search and rescue. So I'm almost out.
You're saying you love it for working out. Has it gotten better over time, or what long-term thing have you felt, or if nothing?
Well, I think the main thing is it gives me a better workout, and that has good results over time. Yeah, for sure.
That's what I found without even knowing.
Yeah.
And then O'Keefe's like, oh, it made my vision better, and Rob Dew goes, we have a bunch of callers already saying that. Did you see these studies about it, like curing glaucoma? And I'm not going to say we're not selling this a drug. I'm not saying it's going to do that. I'm like, God, this stuff's crazy. No, they don't want you to know about it. It's like ivermectin.
Right, exactly. Old school stuff.
But you can't take it if you're on SSRIs. And folks, it's so strong. Talk to your doctor first because it's not a game. Ours is really strong. If you'll just try it, you'll be hooked, and we can fund the operation. It's a win-win. We'll be right back with Stuart Rhodes.
Taking a record of the hearts and minds of the American people, it's the American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the American Journal. Go today to thealexjonesstore.com, get your Shilajit gummy pack, which there's a ton in here. It's in one of these situations where the bottle is, big, but there's not a lot. No, it's like jammed all the way to the top with these gummies. 60 servings. So that's a 2 month supply if you only take one a day as directed. But I wouldn't blame you if you're taking a little bit more than that, because they are delicious and they work well. Your daily boost in vitality, Shilajit gummies. Try them out today. Go support us at thealexjonesstore.com. Make the commitment. Be a part of this movement and understand that we're not going anywhere, folks. Well, I shouldn't say that. We're actually going to continue going wherever the hell we want, regardless who wants us to stop or doesn't want us going anywhere. We are going to continue to grow. We are going to continue to evolve and transform. And
manifest our will on reality, whether the bad guys want it or not. You can help us do this and join us in this mission by going to thealexjonesstore.com. Go to thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison to let them know who sent you. I'm just going to go through some of these headlines, and then I want to touch on a very bizarre story about mass migration in UK and how people are dealing with it. From AF Post on X, Jerusalem has frozen the bank account of the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem, which represents roughly half of Palestinian Christians and is one of the largest landholders in Israel. The Knesset, for example, is built on land leased from the Orthodox Church. The Patriarch, Patriarchate manages not only churches, but also schools, hospitals, and welfare services for Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank. In an email from the Jerusalem municipality, Israeli officials defended the freeze, saying administrative enforcement proceedings are initiated against the Greek Patriarchate for failing to settle their property tax obligations on assets that are not used as houses of worship. And we actually covered this earlier this year when the decision was first made to try to get taxes out of the Orthodox Church, despite them being the landowners who have been there forever and grandfathered in their tax-exempt status. And this has nothing to do with administrative whatever excuse they're using. It's very clear it's not complicated at all. Right now, Israel is massively expanding its illegal terroristic West Bank settlements. The West Bank, of course, in 1948 was 85% Christian. Since then, it's dwindled down to about 10% Christian, but it is home to one of the largest Christian populations in the Middle East that have been there forever, and now the Israelis are moving on the West Bank, so Muslims and Christians alike are being displaced so the area can be Judaized and annexed into Israel proper. This is totally illegal. It is in complete and flagrant violation of multiple, not just international laws on the books as established by the Geneva Convention and all these other, all these other meetings that all the countries have at the end of wars to, establish rules of conflict to govern geopolitical strife in the future, but also agreements that Israel themselves have agreed to, right? You've got settlements, the Oslo Accords and others where Israel signs agreements, whether it's facilitated by Switzerland or America. You've got Palestinians and Israelis both agreeing to terms, and then the Israelis break those terms. So when we talk about the West Bank settlements and the expansion now being activated are illegal, even though Mike Johnson is going and visiting them and encouraging them. Totally ridiculous. It doesn't just violate international law as imposed by an outside body. It violates the agreements that Israel themselves have made in terms of who owns what land and what the conditions are there. Israel considers military recruitment inside USA as soldier shortage persists, which I think is kind of a funny headline because it's presenting this as if this doesn't always happen and hasn't always happened. Israel considers military recruitment inside USA as soldier shortage persists. Now, a lot of people saw this and thought that meant they would just be recruiting like American Christians, and maybe they would, but I don't think so. No, what they say is they're trying to, recruit from their diaspora. They're trying to recruit from the Jewish population living in the United States and other countries around the world, which they already do to a very large degree. And a huge, 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 huge number of IDF soldiers are like college kids from America that go and serve in the IDF for a year. And I have like a million reasons why that should not be allowed as Americans, but I think they're all fairly obvious. According to Israeli Army Radio, a state media outlet, Israel may mount an effort to recruit 600 to 700 Jews a year from the diaspora, a term referring to Jews living somewhere other than Israel. At first, Israel would concentrate its efforts in the United States and France, the countries with the two largest Jewish populations, at roughly 6 million and 450,000 respectively. In February, there are 3,500 diaspora soldiers serving in the IDF, with nearly 900 of them Americans. Israel calls such troops lone soldiers. The majority of American lone soldiers are coming after high school, either directly after high school or after a gap year program, said Noya Gavrin, director of the Lone Soldiers Program. at a nonprofit that encourages Americans and Canadians to make aliyah, that is to move to Israel and become citizens. In the past 2 years, there have been a noticeable increase in college graduates that come to Israel to serve as lone soldiers, she said in the Times of Israel. The IDF is coping with a 10,000 to 12,000 soldier shortfall. There are two principal drivers, draft dodging by ultra-Orthodox Israelis and lower retention of current soldiers who are leaving the IDF at an elevated rate as the war in Gaza nears its second anniversary. Some are voluntarily leaving via extreme means. At least 16 soldiers have killed themselves in 2025 and 54 since October 7th. More than 3,700 have been diagnosed with PTSD. There are some 14,600 deserters, according to the Jerusalem Post. The IDF is about to close the window on a sort of amnesty plan, which gives draft dodgers until Thursday to sign up for a service by phone or online that could be rapidly ushered into the IDF's ranks in the coming weeks. If they do, they'll be spared criminal charges and penalties that include prohibition on foreign travel. So Israel is trying to take over Gaza. At the same time, they're rattling the saber and talking about going to war once again in Iran. They're trying to carve up the western parts of Syria as we speak. And they still have Hezbollah and the Yemeni Houthis to deal with. In addition to all of that, they're finding that their manpower is massively short for all of these attempts, and they've been incapable so far of tricking America into providing the soldiers they need to carry out the Greater Israel Project. So they're trying to recruit from the American diaspora, which they already have thousands of soldiers that are American in the IDF. And again, I worry about this because, I mean, look at the story that we had of the Israeli cyber security director, you know, got caught as a pedophile, and he was released back to Israel by, an IDF, a former IDF operative, Israeli first DA in that position of power. And it's like, I wonder, I mean, if I've got a friend that goes to Israel on a gap year and joins the IDF and then comes back to America, I mean, where would his loyalty lie if he got a call one day from the IDF, from his battalion commander, saying, hey, we got a mission for you? You know? Is he going to say no? He took an oath. Is he going to, do something that would be against the interests of America? Maybe. Would he even know it was against the interests of America? I mean, do we have at this point thousands of, IDF sleeper cells in America receiving instruction? Why would we allow that? I mean, am I the crazy one here? Or if you serve in a foreign army, should you not be an American citizen anymore? That doesn't seem that crazy to me. Sort of you have to choose one or the other. Not now. Right now you can serve as a congressman like Brian Mast and wear your IDF uniform into the Capitol and fly the Israeli flag over the American one in your office. So why we allow any of this is absolutely beyond me. And it's only because Israel enjoys this special position where it doesn't get treated like any other government would and should. Meanwhile, Kentucky judge killed by sheriff ran courthouse like a brothel and traded sex for favors at twisted parties, according to the victim. The rural Kentucky judge, gunned down in his own chambers last year, ran a twisted sex ring in which young women were coaxed into performing sexual favors just to get out of trouble, one of the alleged victims claims. Taya Adams alleged she was among those caught up in Judge Kevin Mullins's apparent sex for favors scheme that saw him and others in the tiny town of Whitesburg demand sex in exchange for cash or get offenders off the hook. Adams told News Nation's Banfield that Mullins, who was shot execution style in his County Chambers, allegedly by his longtime sheriff pal Sean Steins last September, had warned her to keep quiet about the so-called depraved ring. "We would do sex parties and perform shows and have sex with them for money, things like that," Adams alleged. "It was consensual. It was the thing that we were so young, and then they used it against us to destroy our lives later." I remember at the time, there were rumors that this judge had been caught by the sheriff, like texting the sheriff's daughter or something. And I remember at the time we covered this, and we said, we don't really know what the case is here. What we do know is how both of the men involved look on their faces. And that was enough for me to decide this judge may have had something coming. Can we bring up a picture of this judge? I just want to know if it's a type of face you would trust your young daughter with. I think it's nice to be able to see these things. The claims only add to the disturbing allegations that have emerged in the wake of Mullins' chilling caught on camera slaying last year, including that the slain judge been running the courthouse like a brothel. It has since been revealed one woman, Sabrina Adkins, threw Mullins' name into the mix during a 2022 criminal investigation into a Letcher County deputy sheriff who was later jailed for rape and sodomy of a female inmate. Now, that's the best picture I've seen of him. And it's still not great. It's unclear if the alleged sextortion scheme had anything to do with Mullins' shooting. You know, you'd think if there's one place where, like, corruption didn't enter, it would be a small town courtroom. Some judge who spends 90% of his time dealing with, like, open bottle tickets and speeding tickets. Some people you can't even trust with just even a tiny little ounce of power. Even just a modicum, just a tiny dollop of power goes right to their head and they go completely insane. I'm looking up the picture. Kevin Mullins. Judge Kevin Mullins. Donna, do people know this story? I mean, look at this guy. Oh, wait. Look at that face. You're telling me that guy ran a sex ring? What? You're telling me this lovable, trustworthy face was holding jail time over women's heads unless they did things to him? My God, I can't believe it. You know, sometimes you just can't judge a book by its cover. I don't know. Maybe he's innocent. I don't know. All I know is, you know, it's like all these things. I don't know, man. Would we not be better off if, like, could we just put the most handsome person in charge? What if we just put the most handsome person in charge?
I am.
There's something metaphysical in charge here. Well, he is. Donald Trump. The golden man. But you ever notice, like, I'm not one to judge people on their physical appearance. I was raised better than that. I understand looks can be deceiving. But there is sort of a continuity, isn't there? There's sort of an association you can make. That, like, a lot of our enemies are just ugly. Why is that? I don't know. I don't know why it is, but it's pretty universal. And then you show a pretty girl on an ad and everybody goes crazy and calls you a Nazi. You show Sydney Sweeney putting pants on. And it's like you've committed a crime against nature. At least that's what we're told by the shuffling pot-bellied gremlins that deign to rule over us. From justthenews.com, IRS began criminal probe into Clinton Foundation in 2019, then suddenly stopped, memo show. Was a major investigation derailed? Quote, can't talk about the CF, an IRS memo states in recounting how IRS agents suddenly cut off contact with whistleblowers providing information after months of cooperation. Years after the FBI was forced to shut down multiple corruption probes of Bill and Hillary Clinton's charity, the IRS, under President Donald Trump, began a criminal tax investigation into the Clinton Foundation and its dealings with other players on the global charity stage, but then abruptly stopped working with whistleblowers in spring 2019, according to IRS memos and internal emails reviewed by Just the News. The documents released under the Freedom of Information Act add a new body of evidence about the federal government's concerns about the former First Family's famous global charity, as well as persistent narrative of federal agents being thwarted in their pursuit of investigations tied to major Democrat Party figures. So we just need to fire those up again, I guess. And in addition, look into who tried to shut them down in the first place. This is an article that is not exactly new. Maybe we'll save it for another time. We haven't touched too much on it, but it's something that I'm very, very happy the Trump administration is doing, and that is confronting and dismantling the anti-white propaganda at the Smithsonian. From the AmericanConservative.com, Smithsonian's anti-white propaganda. It says, look at a stunning exhibit from the website of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture on a webpage that's about the menace of whiteness. Aside from the anti-white stereotypes here, notice the inadvertently anti-black insanity. Things like hard work, being on time, cause and effect, rational thinking, respect for authority, and politeness, all these things, according to the museum, are manifestations of whiteness. Did David Duke write this stuff? It's crazy. If a white man said that black people are lazy, can't keep a schedule, have no respect for authority, can't think straight, are rude, etc., he would be rightly criticized as racist, but there it is, at the taxpayer-funded National Museum of African American History and Culture. Why? Why do we pay for this racial propaganda? The museum itself looks fantastic, but this is disgusting. The museum teaches black people that being on time for work is racist oppression. Don't believe me? Look, what kind of country do these museum curators want? And it's the same image that we've shown over and over and over again, which is just the aspects of whiteness as published by the Smithsonian. And yeah, literally, it's like being on time, having respect, personal property, aspects and assumptions of whiteness and white culture in the United States. I'm not going to say what race wrote this chart, all right? They were Jewish, to quote Kanye West. But this is the type of stuff that Trump is confronting. Trump is, you know, telling the Smithsonian, hey, you got to get all this crap out. And then the mainstream media is reporting it frantically with their hair on fire, going, Trump is trying to impose his view of America on the Smithsonian. And he's doing away. They're not teaching about slavery anymore. Is this the type of stuff that you want? And that's not even really the anti. I mean, it's anti-white in that it is aligned with everything, just portraying aspects of the European culture, yeah, white culture, as if it's bad. And so Trump wants to get rid of it, and these people are freaking out and not letting it. So again, just the same thing we deal with every single day over and over and over again. It's like, where do you start the cycle? Okay, if everything was fine, if the Smithsonian was just doing their job, just plugging away, just we're focused on history, we don't racialize anything, we dig up fossils, and we tell stories about Harriet Tubman. Like, if they were just doing normal stuff, oh, look, a spaceship, isn't that cool? No one would have a problem with it. And then if Trump came in and went, actually, you need to change everything to fit my view of, yeah, you'd look at that and go, this is authoritarian, this is crazy. Well, no, the Smithsonian doesn't have to bend its will to the American president just because he has his own ideology, he wants to import it. Yeah, I'd be against that too. But you forget that Trump is only doing this in response to years upon years upon years of concerted anti-white propaganda from the Smithsonian, where they've got plaques on all the walls criticizing, you know, saying whites are the ones who invented slavery and racializing everything and calling, you know, aspects of whiteness things like being on time or pulling yourself up from your bootstraps. And it's like, this is offensive. This is horrible. This is just hateful and wrong. So Trump is coming in to fix it, to get back to how it should be. But if you don't tell that story, then you can portray it as Trump coming in and imposing his own view. And it's just a lie. From Ground.News, I mentioned this article earlier. Debate emerges on the role of empathy as some Christian conservatives challenge its value. That's a lie. That's a mischaracterization. Historian Susan Lanzoni notes a shift in the perception of empathy, which has been co-opted politically, particularly regarding progressive views on kindness and morality. There is such a thing as, like, suicidal empathy. But, you know, the thing about empathy is it's not sympathy. You don't have to agree with the thing that you empathize with. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm using the word wrong. To me, I can empathize with a thief. And I can understand the mindset that compels somebody to be a thief. That doesn't mean I'm justifying the position or agree with the position. It just means I can model the brain that makes that decision. I can project as if I was one with that idea, how I would feel, what would be my motivation, how I would justify it to myself. It's still wrong. It's still bad. But if you want to solve it, you have to understand what it is that's compelling them. With anything, with you know, thievery or squatters or whatever, or migrants coming into this country and taking advantage of our, you know, welfare system, whatever it is. I get it. I can empathize with you, and I can say if I was in your position, if I'd been raised like you, if I had the values you have, yes, I would go and do this thing. Okay? It's still wrong. You're still a bad person for doing it, but you can empathize with bad. Do people not know that? Do people not know you can empathize with bad people and still think that they're bad? You can empathize with both sides of a conflict in order to best understand the motivations behind both the parties involved. Especially, it's necessary to do that if you want to stop the situation from occurring. And that most of the problem that we deal with, and the thing I started this show rambling about, is the lack of the ability of people to model the minds of their enemies. Literally the number one rule of war: understand your enemy. Now, the really interesting thing about that, so you have to understand your enemy to defeat them, but once you truly understand your enemy, you kind of have to love them. Like, you can't understand something that you don't love. You can't love something you don't understand. And so there is this ultimate sort of ironic conclusion at the end of it, where you just arrive at what Jesus Christ said 2,000 years ago, which is you need to love your enemy. But you need to love your enemy even if you are trying to defeat them, even though they're your enemy, and even though you can disagree or not give any credence to the things that they feel. How do you not have the ability to understand how they feel? And again, this is something that I think sort of underlies a lot of my coverage, if you've noticed. Is trying to explain, here's the position of the bad people doing the bad thing. Here's why they're doing it. Here's what motivates them. And it's bad and we need to stop them. But you need to empathize. You need to understand where they're coming from, what's motivating them, in order to counteract and defeat them. Without empathy, you're lost. And that's what frustrates me so much about a lot of the conflict, the internecine, the inter-right-wing conflict that goes on. Because you have a lot of people that are just completely incapable of understanding ideas they don't agree with, or understanding mindsets that are contrary to their own. So empathy can be weaponized and be, you know, utilized, you know, to your detriment. So I'm absolutely against, you know, empathy being so powerful that it, you know, caused you to give your country away because some criminal is crying about the laws that he doesn't like. You know, so what? Shut up. We have to have empathy for him. So again, I see so much of this as just the false dichotomy where it's like you either have to be super empathetic and loving, in which case you have to give your country away now. Give us your children. Give us your heritage. Give us your inheritance. Aren't you empathetic? Or you have to just be heartless and just go, I hate everybody else. Everybody else needs to die. These are your only options if you're a stupid person. If you're an intelligent person, you say, I understand completely why these people are doing it, and we shouldn't allow them to. We have to stop them now.
What really makes a nutraceutical work? What is a nutraceutical? What is a supplement? Yeah, I mean, let's just talk about Power Plant, for example. So Methyl Drive is something that everyone, whether they're 12 or whether they're 90, they should all take it. Power Plant is a little bit more specific. It's good for both men and women. I would say it has a stronger, more pronounced factor on the younger side, especially people that are into high-intensity exercise. Key ingredient in that is cordyceps, which increases your oxygen-carrying capacity, but it also increases ATP, and it also helps you make new mitochondria. So imagine taking something like cordyceps found in Power Plant and then combining it with Methyl Drive. But oh, wait, there's also total male mineral support in Power Plant. We've got zinc, which increases luteinizing hormone, which makes you produce more testosterone. But then to counteract the rise in sex hormone binding globulin, we include boron in it to increase your free testosterone. That's something that normal formulas don't do. We've got the thing that creates free testosterone in your body in Power Plant, according to studies. That's Mainline. You can Google it.
And not all CoQ10 is the same, right?
Everyone should take CoQ10. Listen, and if you're going to take CoQ10, you're going to go to some store or some pharmacy, and they're going to try to sell you a bottle with the same amount that's in here for like $50. You get CoQ10 plus four other ingredients with this.
It's true. And the same amount.
Same amount. It's incredible. We make this stuff for you and for ourselves. Everyone at the InfoWars office is gobbling these supplements left and right. That's why I made these, is so I could take them.
And then you designed it to go with our ultramethylene blue.
Absolutely. That's the key. Before any, like, man or woman, young and old, if you're on methylene blue, you got to take it.
Everybody loves the formulas, and I've noticed if I take both together, the energy is totally insane. Each one is very strong on its own.
Methyl Drive is something that every person in the country should take.
So the methylene blue is like the engine and gasoline. These products together is a nitrous oxide.
Exactly. It turbocharges.